Welcome back to the Pro Wrestling Super Show, episode some number that I didn't look up. My name's Steven, joined as always with Tim. Did we lose Tim?
Uh-oh. Sounds like it.
I'm joined, as always, with Matt Feuerstein.
Hi, how's it going? It's good to be able to talk about silly stuff.
Are you guys, am I going in and out here? Hold on.
I think you were just out for a couple minutes.
No, you were out.
So yeah, I'm joined, as always, with
Tim. Give me just a second here, hold on.
All right, we're still going. And Barikla, how are you doing, Barikla?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
I'm good.
I was about to say, it's good that we can talk about silly stuff in a times like this, isn't it, everybody? Just have some fun.
Let's talk about fun things and not all of the things that are ruining the world right now. So,
Well, it's funny that you're doing this sort of as like it's almost like a March Madness style thing, and March Madness is going to be empty arena. Wow.
There is a madness going around this March, but not the one you think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm back now. I'm good to go. Okay, let's do this damn thing.
Awesome. Okay, so if you joined us last podcast, we did a tournament style thing where we each picked four of a thing, and then we argued until we all agreed what was the best of that thing.
Yeah, it was match time. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you didn't listen to that, it was a lot of fun. The best gimmick matches. And we're going to do it again, but with the best title reigns. So before we hammer that out, Tim, what is a title reign and what makes it good?
It's wild because I think back in the early days, I think when people really put a lot of thought into what people wanted out of a title holder, it was somebody that was going to draw house, right? They were going to get the guys to be able to go around and be the guys that would face the top territorial guy in that territory, and it would be a big deal, right? And I think back in the earlier days, when that was really the big thing about it, that was kind of the determining factor more so than match quality or any of the other things that have become in vogue. But I think the one thing I'm going to be interesting to know about this is what modern title reigns are we going to pick? Because
I have one. At least.
Yeah, I think we all have maybe one or two, and I think the question just kind of becomes like what's the determining factor there? And there's a couple I think that definitely I think are standing out from their length, right? I think the longer title reigns are kind of what everybody kind of goes right for. It's like these guys who held the belts for so long and really did everything great. But yeah, like I'm going to be very interested to see what does and what doesn't get picked here. Like I said, I think there's a couple things that I've told you guys this in our lead up to this. It's like there are two reigns that I'm hoping get picked by other people. And if they don't get picked, then I'll pick them. But I have a feeling I know which ones will be picked. So I'm hoping that this exercise has the variety that I'm hoping for, but it's I don't know. It's because of what the definition of this has changed over the past couple of decades. I'm not sure if what people want out of a title reign now is exactly as good as probably what people thought of more classical title reigns. I think we were all used to growing up.
Yeah, and to clarify, it's any type of title reign, any type of title, any length of time. Any promotion, pick your own adventure. And I just thought of one, thanks to Tim's little spiel. And I'm going to write that on a notepad, so if no one else picks it, which I have no idea if anyone will, I am going to definitely pick it. So I'm going to write that down now. It will replace one of my other picks, maybe. So Matt, what do you think? What do you think? What's up?
How you thinking? About title reigns is what you're asking me, right?
Or whatever. If you want to talk about anything else, go for it. But if you want to stay on topic, you can.
I'm going to stay on topic for this one because I need to talk about something like this today. Title reigns, I mean, I guess for a lot of us nowadays, it's usually about the matches that a champion has during that reign, right? Like that's something that's the easiest way to judge a title reign. Did they have a shitload of great title defenses along the way in that title reign? And like Tim said, the length usually applies to it. It's funny because, you know, during the old days, like the really old days before any of us were alive, title reigns could last for years and years and years, right? And so it's kind of hard to pin down those. Like, and those were because the champion was drawing. And so – and in the, with the NWA, you know, there's a lot of credibility involved in who became champion. And I'm sure, like, by, like, a lot of metrics, some of the best title reigns were, like, I don't know, Lou Thesz in the 50s or whatever. And I, you know, couldn't possibly pick those because I have not seen enough of them. But, you know, as things got – kept going, title reigns got shorter and shorter and shorter. And by like the late 90s and like very early 2000s, titles were just flip-flopping all over the place, especially in America, because they had to keep ratings up, Monday Night Wars and stuff like that. And then there was a movement in the mid-2000s, you know, probably thanks to like Noah and the indies, of going back to these old title reigns of like let's just say long title reigns. But, you know, long being like a year or two as opposed to like five or six. And then things sort of leveled out. Like even WWE tried some really long title reigns, you know, with Punk and Brock Lesnar.
And Cena. And
Cena. Cena had a really long reign in 2007, and I think Punk bested it. But I think like Cena had like a reign, and then it was interrupted. So if you took them together, they were long. So like I was thinking about like, you know, like in the 80s, Ric Flair would hold a title for a really long time, but there'd be like a couple month period in between. You know, where he would lose it to a guy and win it back, you know, and, you know, like with Ricky Steamboat or Ronnie Garvin. And sometimes I think about like do those count as all different reigns because they sort of are thematically one reign, but technically they're different reigns. So it's a lot to think about when it comes to title reigns. I guess, you know, the classic title reigns in modern era and for a lot of people anyway, would be the New Japan, like IWGP. Championship reigns of Okada, Tanahashi, guys like that. But you know, sometimes those like run together a little bit also. So it's kind of hard to pin down. Like you said, the modern reigns are going to be tough.
Yeah, for sure. And like, there's also a lack of footage. Like Terry Funk's NWA World Title reign would probably be absolutely unbelievable, but I've seen like none of it, right? So
yeah,
I can't pick it. But it's gonna. Sure these are awesome.
The reigns I'm gonna pick are mostly gonna be reigns from when I was currently watching, or maybe some from like the 80s where like a lot of footage is available. I'm not going back much further than that.
I'm only picking things I've seen. So.
Yeah.
What about Barikla? How many Carlos Corone reigns are there?
Well, he's considered he's like a 26-time Universal Champ.
No.
This is like Jerry, like trying to pick a Jerry Lawler reign. It goes to Matt's point that you know, there's a lot of these. You have this incumbent champ that has this long period of time where they're mainly the champ, but there's always these blips where they
drop the title to a challenger for a bit of a spell and then they regain it. So how do you – technically it's not the same reign, but it's kind of like the
same era of being champion. So it's going to be a little tough basically when you have somebody that's multiple reigns of similar length, you know, which one do you pick to represent them if you really think there's one
worth – you know, it's worth picking them. For this,
I'll give a WWF example. Like, there's a part of me that would really want to pick like Bret Hart's Intercontinental Title reign in '91 and '92, but there was like a 2 month period where the Mountie and Roddy Piper were champion.
Right.
So those
exactly.
two separately wouldn't really amount to it. But if you put them all both together, those would be great reign. That would be a great reign.
That's the issue, basically. I mean, there's quite a few ones that I was looking at them, and I was like, oh, yeah, and then, but he lost it for like 3 months and then regained it and then held it on. There's one example that I'm not going to mention because I might actually pick this one where it's frustrating because if you take out the blips at both ends, it'd be one really long reign that would be absolutely terrific. But
there's a blip near the beginning, and there's a blip
near the end where he loses it to a challenger temporarily for like a month or a month and a half at most. The other thing is with title reigns, I mean, the one thing I think that I always find interesting is a title made credible by the champion who has it, or is the champion made credible by the title they have? That's and I think with the best reigns, it's a case of where the wrestler holding it probably elevates the title.
Yeah, I definitely have a couple examples of both, honestly.
Yeah, but I would lean more towards that. But you can definitely have another case where the title itself is what raises the champion's profile.
One thing, just to before we start actually picking these, that I want to talk about with that particular comment is that I think more and more today, a lot of people see the belt as a prop. Yeah. And that's kind of the thing, is that a lot of these belts that hold this lineage and hold these really important things that were done with them, nowadays it's just more of like a way to
– whose turn is it?
Make people – yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, yeah. Like that's what a lot of people are talking about. Like right now, it's like – with Street Profits holding the Raw tag team titles, or when Drew, if he wins on whenever WrestleMania is, if he beats Brock, what does that look like? What do we do? You know, is it the belt made him, or did he make the belt, or what have you? And so,
Kofi last year, for example, I mean, as great as the whole run up and the whole him winning the title, I mean, that was the pinnacle, him winning it. After that, it's like, what do you do with that?
And I think the other thing about that, and I'll say this about something like a Kofi reign, is that at some point, there has to be a decision made to, as a company, right? You have to determine what is the importance of the title. And I think a lot of reason why, you know, there's a lot of modern fans who really are drawn to New Japan, for example, is because the belt means something. Especially after such a tumultuous time where the belt really didn't mean anything until the aforementioned Tanahashi long reign, it's one of those things that now I think with more eyes on the product since NJPW World started up, that people realize is like, well, they actually make this title mean something. And that argument can be made, and I think we're going to probably make that argument during some of our selections, but I think that's going to be a crucial thing to think about when we're like making these decisions or coming to decisions on these matchups, are at what point does the fact that the title lineage was built up as something meaningful really drive home why that title reign was important?
Yeah. And one other thing I just wanted to bring up before we start to determine the field here with the selection show. As I am stealing from March Madness even more, you hear a lot of people go, oh, this person should have been champion and this person should have been champion. And I think that comes from the modern aspect of like the title being just like a reward that you kind of give to anyone who's been moderately successful, as opposed to like, really, Jake Roberts should have been champion. When are you going to take the title off of Hogan? You aren't. Jake Roberts never should have been champion. And you carry that kind of shit all the time. So I think, as we were talking about with a divide in the way the title meant, like, yeah, the title at one point was for the top star. And it was to draw money. And sometimes it's just like a, you know, a gold pin at the end of your career. So who knows what we're going to look at here. But Tim, I'm going to let you go first. I've heard you talk about a certain title reign multiple times, and I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you're going to pick it. And if you don't, I'm going to be surprised, and I'll see who else picks it. But why don't you go first?
Yeah, I mean, there are two reigns that I'll wait for three and four, although I think Matt picks second here, right?
Yeah.
So we might know one of them by the time Matt's done, but yeah, I'm pretty sure. So there's two that I'm thinking of, but I'm guessing the one that I've probably talked about the most on this is the Kenta Kobashi GHC title reign from March 2003 to March 2005, almost 2 years to the day. So this is – it's a double-edged sword. It is a title reign that a lot of people think was in some ways the death knell for the company because of what happened at the end of it. We'll talk about that when we get there. But I do feel that it is, in our generation of fans, the most memorable foreign title reign, probably until the Okada title reign, or maybe even the Tanahashi reign, depending on where you, if you're New Japan Phantom Lions. But I don't think people understand how much people were waiting around on YouTube. And I mean this. I want you to think about this sentence. We're waiting for title matches to hit YouTube.
Well, actually, this was pre-YouTube, so it was like
right.
the wild west of like downloading and like finding things on message boards and like, yeah, like it was crazy.
Because LimeWire.
Exactly. Yeah. But there are people who are hoping that, you know, and then eventually when Kobashi retired, they put the entire title reign up there for people to see from start to finish. So it was a big deal. And I think we'll talk more about it as we go on. But, yeah, I mean, this was kind of an easy number one for me. I think even with the other two reigns I have in mind for what could be picked, that I think I was still taking this number one. But I think that it might be the kind of inflection point for the last great traditional title reign, meaning both from a house drawing standpoint and from a match quality standpoint that really holds water. So
also, you know, Noah was a few years old when this match happened, when Kobashi beat Misawa, right. And that match really like put Noah on the level of All Japan for a lot of people, partially because of how great it was and partially because of how Dave Meltzer, you know, say what you want about him, but his hype of that match really got everyone paying attention to that company in a way they hadn't for the previous couple of years. Because it was a five-star match in an era where like he wasn't giving those out constantly.
Right.
And like he would just talk about it constantly. So that, you know, made me actually get a videotape. And luckily that came with like a whole compilation of other Kobashi Misawa matches. And then you also had – that was during that reign, the first Noah Tokyo Dome show with Akiyama against Kobashi. Another great match. There were tons of great matches. Wasn't there a great match with him and Takayama at one point as well?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, we'll go through it when I'm trying to build my case, you know. But there's a reason why that title reign is held in this such high regard because, like I said, I think it's that confluence of match quality and actual business, like what it meant for business, both good and bad in some ways. But we'll talk about that when we get into specifics.
Yeah. All right, Matt. I think you have – if I'm correct, because I'm one for one, a very similar reign, but an American reign instead, or
yeah.
I'm horribly wrong.
No, you're right. I almost want to like put this one down on the list because it's like too hard of a contest at this point between those the reign that Tim picked and this one. But I am the host of Through the Years. I am currently doing 2004, so. I would be not doing my duty if I did not pick Samoa Joe's title reign, which began on March 22, 2003 and ended on December 26, 2004, both in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for Ring of Honor. I can't imagine that anyone listening to this doesn't know about this title reign. It brought long title reigns back to the U.S., took ROH to another level. We'll get to it when I'm defending it, but yeah, I think I'm living up to my expectations by picking this reign, of course.
And I had to like change the brackets around, so I made sure those two were on opposite sides, just to be safe.
Yeah. Good going.
It might not be the two finalists. You never know, but I just wanted to be safe, because who knows? Bariko's number one pick could be the finalist instead. What do you have?
Well, it's probably a boring and safe pick, but it's one that definitely should be on this list, and that is Hulk Hogan's first WWF title reign from January of '84 to the main event in 1988 when the whole double ref deal went down.
Well, I didn't think of that, but that's a fucking great pick. And,
we'll talk about it. That's why I'm not trying to say too much. But I think at the very least, it's a reign that definitely deserves to be at least among our picks to discuss.
In some ways, that's probably the most important title reign in the history of professional wrestling. So
yeah,
that's going to be a hell of a one to talk about. So
yeah, absolutely.
All right. So my number one, I'm going full nostalgia. Kind of the first big title reign of me watching wrestling, one that has an amazing story from start to finish, and that's Randy Savage's WrestleMania 4 to WrestleMania 5 title reign.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, yes. that was a huge bet by Hogan or by Vince, right? To basically say, Randy, you get the ball for a year. Let's see what you can do. And it worked.
Defined by probably the greatest year-long storyline that company ever did. So
all around the one title, plus a lot of great challengers as well during the feud, but I'll argue that later. Matthew, what do you got?
All right. Well, I know that I'm the one Ric Flair defender on this panel, I wanted to pick a Ric Flair title reign, and it was tough to figure out which one because he had, you know, during the 80s, he had a lot of really good reigns. I settled on his reign that began on May 7th, 1989, and ended on July 7th, 1990. So, right. So the one where he wins it back from Steamboat to when he loses it to Sting, I will get to why I chose that one. But I think if I really had to pick a Flair NWA title reign, that I like could really attest to, that's the one that I would pick. And Ric Flair was a great champion in the 80s. I will defend that one till the death.
No one's going to argue that. Come
yeah. One
just,
thing that
I just don't think he understands wrestling psychology, but that's between you here and there now. Tim, sorry, I interrupted you. And then you make your pick after you make your point.
Yeah. Well, I will say, that, of course, that Matt picking the Samoa Joe was about as big a shoe-in as me picking Kenta. So that was pretty – like I was sitting there going, like, if Matt doesn't make that in his first two picks, I don't know what's going on. So I'm glad that got chosen. I'm going to stay in Japan. I'm going to be very – I just realized my list is very Japan-heavy, and I'm fine with that because I think it's going to be matched up with a lot of these kind of challenges from a U.S. title reign perspective that are going to be – they'll have to be answered relatively quickly. And so
yeah,
my second
I'm
one –
I'm the counterpoint.
Yeah, right?
And I'm so going to be more U.S.-based.
Yeah. And so my second one is Mitsuhara Misawa's first Triple Crown reign from September of 1992 to August of 1994. So that was – Jumbo is down, like – he is hurt. His health is failing him. We've gone with Misawa for a couple of years. He's going to go over Hansen with the elbow, and we're going to see what we do with him. And it turns out to be an era-defining title reign with some of the most important matches of his career and in the history of Japanese professional wrestling, including perhaps one of the most famous matches in the history of wrestling, the June 3rd, 1994 match with Kawada. It's probably a title reign that gets swept under the rug for some reason, because I think All Japan is defined by its peaks as opposed to its kind of steadiness throughout the 90s, and Misawa holding the title for his first reign and doing what he did with it was remarkable. So I'm very happy to start talking about that when we get there.
Awesome. Yeah, me too. Because that's stuff I've all watched and within the last – fuck. When was the greatest wrestler ever?
2016? Yeah, so 2015. Yeah, 2015, 2016, yeah.
So, oh, man, we're coming up on the next – anyways, let's get away from that. Barwikwa, what do you got?
All right. For my second selection, I'm actually going to go with my Homer pick.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, I try to figure out. So let me just – I'm looking up just to make sure I got the correct dates. Now, obviously, for me, the Homer pick would be something from down here in Puerto Rico. So we're going to go with the Universal title, the World Wrestling Council, the actual Universal title, not the one WWE has.
Right.
And we're going to pick, out of all the reigns, we're going to go with Carlos Colon's fifth Universal title reign, which started on September 21st, 1986, and went all the way to July 18th of 87. Yeah, it actually is. It's about 300 days. And I'll get into the specifics as to why this specific reign. But if you notice, it's 86 to 87. There's a certain feud, famous feud that took place during that particular reign.
Oh. Kind of a big deal.
Along with the other things we'll talk about when I discuss it in further depth, but that's one of the linchpins to why this particular reign is the one being picked.
That's clever. I like this. My number two pick is going to be one that is fairly recent and one I really loved at the time and is kind of a lot different than the ones we have selected, but I'm going to go with Asuka's NXT Women's Title Reign.
This was one I was figure was going to be picked, and it was one that if it didn't get to me for my last pick, I was going to take it, but I figured that it would be taken.
Nice. I was trying hard to think of a modern like reign like that, and like you're right, you picked the right one.
Yeah, for sure.
Matt.
All right. Well, this next reign is another one that you might have predicted I was going to pick, and it's very, very special to me personally because I was there the day it began, live. I was there the day it ended, live. I was there for a lot of the matches in between. Bryan Danielson, Ring of Honor, September 17, 2005 to December 23rd, 2006. Just personal pick for me. It was probably the peak of my wrestling fandom.
There's an argument that reign is maybe more important than Joe's. There's an argument. I don't think it's a big one. I don't think it's a great one, but there's an argument for it.
Yeah, you can argue which one is better in the ring. But yeah, the argument about which is more important, I think that one's probably a little bit harder to make. But, you know, I'll try to make the case for both of them.
Well, they're both great, so.
Yeah.
It's starting to get a little more complicated here. Third round. I have a lot of like balls on the table, and like I know Matt was saying earlier, and I think Rico too, about reigns that have like a couple months interruption, and if they didn't have that, they would easily make the list. And I would love to put one on, but I think that interruption kind of hurts it. So I'm gonna go pick one that I don't want to give this person too much credit, but it was a reign I was gonna put. It was going to be maybe a little bit higher, but I'm going to go with Hogan's first NWO title reign from 96 to 97.
That's another one. So
that's an interesting
choice. When we talk about Hogan, it's going to be an amazing conversation. Like,
I don't want to defend a racist, but
he has two of the most memorable title reigns in the history of pro wrestling, and people 100% just throw it out the window for many reasons. So it's interesting. It really is.
Also, if you pick an American wrestling title reign from like before the year 2000, like you're probably going to be defending a racist at some point. So.
Well.
Or worse.
That
or
part. Worse, yeah. That's true. Or worse.
Oh boy. At least no one's picked a murderer yet.
Nope.
So Bariqua, you want to pick a Snuka or Benoit?
Nope, and there's no Invader One picks either.
About to say thank you.
If we did a tournament on like best title wins, I might be defending a murderer for a little bit. But since we're talking about reigns, I'm not. I don't think I have to.
No, no Great Khali picks.
Okay, for my next pick, I think we do need a little more modern representation, as in that last 15 years or so. And basically, I think I'm going to select the John Cena reign.
Yeah.
It's the one from 2006-2007, which is the one that where he won it from TLC versus at a TLC match versus Edge, and it's the one that he ended up vacating because of injury.
Yeah, this one.
This one is frustrating because of that, because it could have gone on so much longer, and it was a heck of a run.
This would be easily top of the list for me if it wasn't the finish. But how much do we take into account the finish?
Right. Yeah. So it's an interesting discussion that we can have about this particular reign.
Oh man. Okay, I'm looking forward to that. Tim, your third pick.
Do you guys ever hear of a country called Japan? So this is another one. It's in my sweet spot. I have to take this one. So this is Aja Kong's 3WA 1992-1995 title reign.
That was on my list.
This literally might be my favorite of the three. Her beating Bull Nakano kind of starts off the great interpromotional period that everybody goes crazy about for Japanese professional wrestling in the 90s. And man, like, what she does during this reign is absolutely incredible, and I can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah, and I was debating between that and Bull Nakano's reign that preceded it.
Yeah,
which is
two very long, very important reigns that did two different things for the business, and really, I think. Well, we'll talk about the end of that reign later. But man, like, there's a couple things in both of those reigns that really kind of set the stage for some incredible business that was done for women's wrestling at the time. So,
all right, Rikla, your final pick.
All right, my final pick. Oh, wait. Okay. Yeah, I'm actually going to go away from the world titles or top championships that we've been doing, because this was a pick that I was debating, and which I mentioned earlier I might pick, and I'm going to go ahead and pick it. So let's set the scene. Picture it. NWA, 1989. You have a wrestler whose focus and obsession is to win the world title. But he can't, because the jerk that's the champion at that time says that no more title matches. So what does he do? He decides to win this title, which automatically makes him the number one contender. So I'm going to go with Lex Luger's 89-90 U.S. title run.
Yeah,
I just pumped my fist like 25 times. I love this title reign so much.
Yeah,
oh
and it's the one I was mentioning earlier that it has a blip near the beginning, a blip near the ending. But if not for those blips, you'd have one long reign with a heck of a story and journey for Luger throughout the reign.
Yeah, we'll talk about the circumstances to the end of it. But man, that's such a great pick. I'm so happy we're going to be talking about that, Rain. Oh God.
All right. My final pick goes all the way back to the year till December of 2018 to May 2019, and that is Orange Cassidy's IWTV Independent title reign. Which, man, the dude took that title, took it to promotion, and just like completely evolved and changed as a wrestler, having a great story and having an amazing start and an amazing finish with a pretty long reign, a good 6 months, which not always common for independent titles. So that's mine right there. If anyone's ever seen any of it.
Yeah, I'm gonna be honest, I have not.
I know Orange, but I haven't seen much about that particular reign.
If you've seen Orange, and the way I'll describe these matches, I might be able to sway someone.
Okay.
Actually, I think I have. That's my number four pick. That's going to be hard. Who the hell is it facing? Oh, it's facing Samoa Joe? Oh, fuck. Okay. Matt, what's your number four pick?
All right. I feel like I have to throw one of these in there. And I know it's probably not going to be popular among this group, but it's one of the legendary reigns of the modern era. So I'm picking it. It's a Kazuchika Okada's fourth IWGP title reign that started in June of 2016 and went all the way to June 2018. It features the Kenny Omega series, you know, maybe controversial, but also incredibly important for and defining of that era of New Japan, and lots of other major, major title defenses, Tokyo Dome main events, all sorts of huge things. It's Okada's most memorable reign, and he's had a few. So, yeah, that's what I'm going with as my final pick.
Yeah, and it's the title reign that made me adopt a 10-star rating system because my 5-star system broke, and I needed to change it.
It's like, definitely
you know the rating system has always been infinite. Everyone knows that.
Yeah, it's definitely a reign that should be that merits discussion. Definitely.
Yeah.
Where are we at? We're at the final one, Tim.
This is one where I have to really think about it because it's like, man, this is kind of the rough patch for me because I think I be perfectly honest with you, you guys picked a lot of my safety nets. Man. Oh, God, there's a I don't know if I want to take that, Ryan. It's like
the reign of terror.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You want to.
I don't know, man. I don't know. This is there's a couple of them. So, damn it. All right, I'm going to throw Steven a bone here.
Really? You're picking Demolition?
No, I was thinking about that. I couldn't talk about the 472-day reign as well as you could. So.
An earthquake was never WWF champion. So.
Sorry about that. I'm going to take Brett's title reign in 1994. Into 95 or 90 at the end of 94. Sorry. That's another sweet spot. So I have three title reigns from roughly the same time. And then Kenta Kobashi. Oh man. Before we go forward. So
I would like to throw in our honorable mentions now before we get into this. Yeah. So Tim,
One I was hoping to talk about, but then I realized it was very short, and therefore I don't think it was going to work out as well as I did, was I wanted to talk about Yoshinobu Kanemaru and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi's IWGP Junior Tag Team title reign in 2002.
Yeah.
The problem is that like half of that feud happened before they won the belts. And the ending of that is amazing when they face Koji Kanemoto and Jushin Liger for it.
Yeah.
But another one that I was thinking about was Liger's very long IWGP reign. I want to say the 95 to 97 reign, I think it was. I want to say it was that reign, but that was the other one I had in mind. But it was kind of rough. I wanted to try and get away from Japan from my last one, because it's like I gotta have something else. I can't be Japan for all four of mine. Yeah.
So. I definitely was thinking Demolition's first tag title reign because it's so fucking great. But man, their feud with the Brainbusters was so good, but like they didn't really have the title during that reign. That's where they lost it, so that kind of sucks. Also, the Super J Crown Ultimo Dragon reign.
Yep, that's a good one.
I love that. And I mentioned Bull. Man, yeah. The Glamour Girls tag title reign in the WWF was pretty fucking great.
Yes, it was.
Jaguar Yokuda's big long reign in the early 80s.
Yeah, 83, 85, yep.
Yeah, there's so many good ones. You know, Brett's ones were all kind of a little short.
Yeah, that's why I didn't pick one. Cause
I picked the 94 one, though, because I think it was memorable, at least for me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very memorable. What about you, Matt? Anything on the cutting board floor?
Yeah, what about Macho Man's Intercontinental title reign?
The one, yeah, where he feuded with Tito, yeah.
And Steamboat, mm-hmm. and, you know, he
San Martino.
Yeah, I mean, I think he kind of put, in some ways, you know, put that title up to another level. You know, he made it a, you know, close to main event. I mean, that Steamboat feud, you know, that, you know, if it wasn't for Hogan and Andre being the other, like, that had as much interest as most main events did. I also, you know, I don't know what you think about this, but I thought that, even though it was sort of interrupted by a couple months by the Sandman, Raven's ECW title reign began in January 96 and ended at Barely Legal. And, you know, like I said, Sandman had it for a little bit in there. But, like, that I thought was an era-defining title reign in terms of storylines. You know, it wasn't, like, great matches, but just, like, really good storylines, really good drama, interesting promos throughout. And that was just like such an important era for ECW as they went to pay-per-view.
And Van Damme's TV title reign, but that is a hell of a reign too.
Yeah, so you had, I think, that and the Taz title reign happening at basically the same time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those are pretty huge choices. The one thing I wish, like, we couldn't figure out a tag team one. That's what sucks.
Yeah, I struggled with that.
Tag teams just don't get those epic lengths. I think that's a big part. Thinking about, like, oh man, the Steiners when they had the WCW tag team titles, but then it's like actually their great matches were split between like multiple reigns. Some of them U.S. tag team titles, some of them world tag team titles. Like they never had like the one defining reign.
Yeah.
I was actually thinking about the Revival's first reign.
Yeah, that's really great.
It's like, damn, like it was shorter than I thought. It was just kind of shit.
The Briscoes in 2007 had a good ROH tag team title reign.
Kane and Mankind, I think, held the title for a couple months.
Yeah.
They did have 2 months.
New Day had that long record-setting reign also in days, but the thing – I didn't pick that because it just dragged – it was obvious at the end they were just – dragging on after it should have ended. Yeah.
And that's the other one. None of us picked CM Punk's reign for very much a similar reason.
Or Honky Tonk Man.
No, I was going to mention that as an honorable mention. I mean, we kind of have an even higher or more better version of that sort of reign in Hogan's 96-97 run of sorts. But yeah, in terms of I was going to mention Honky Tonk Man's Intercontinental title reign as one that probably at least deserves a mention.
What about Mr. Perfect's Intercontinental title reign in 91?
It's really short.
Tornado.
Well, he beat the Tornado. He won it at SummerSlam 90. He lost it to Von Erich for a couple months. But then after he beat the Tornado, he still had really good matches with Big Boss Man. He had a good match with Tito Santana.
To injury.
Yeah,
that's the problem. It's kind of a problem. It's another one where it gets kind of. There's like a parenthesis in the middle, and then he basically takes like a month and a half off just to come over and lose it to Brett.
Yeah.
Well, I was trying to figure out a good lucha reign too, but I couldn't figure it.
I tried, but the problem is that the way titles are usually handled or used in lucha is so sparingly. You get these long reigns, but the title defenses are sparse or used mostly for apuestas matches.
Yeah, didn't Virus have the welterweight title or something for like good 6 or 7 years or something like that? Like he had it for a long time,
and he had all those great matches with. What was that guy's name? Guerrero Mayo Jr.
Oh, yeah, Paraguayo, yeah. So.
And Guerrero.
Guerrero Maya. Yeah.
Also, honorable mention to Ultimo Dragon winning all the belts.
Yeah, that was one that that Steven wanted to put on there before he made it last week.
But it's
George
Cassidy, so that's better. So let's do this. You ready to do this? Yeah. Actually, no. Let's go with Tim. Make your case for Bret Hart in 94.
Well, his first shot at this was halted, right? Like it wasn't the whole Flair thing in 92 and
Hogan.
It was very
came in and fucked.
Yeah, it was very flukish, and he loses to Yokozuna, and then. The next year, he loses to Owen, and then he beats Yokozuna thanks to that really weird finish. but it was really cool how strong he got to be presented for that year, and how at least, you know, even in the Backlund loss at the end of it, you kind of came away with it. It's like, oh yeah, this guy, he knows what he's fucking doing. And the cage match, I think, is very divisive nowadays, but I think it's starting to lean back more towards it's a good match, even though it's not the cage match I think maybe a lot of people were hoping for.
Let me say my piece on that, because
it's
boring.
But I think
it's very boring, but it's not what I want to see in wrestling. However, it is if those rules were the rules of a wrestling match, that match has worked perfectly.
Right.
It's just the rules are stupid. So, yeah.
Okay. But, I agree with that. They work it – considering the logic of the rules to win, it makes total sense in that particular context. Yes.
Yeah, that's my piece on that. All right, go ahead, Tim.
Well, you know, I think that in the end, I think it was one of those reigns that, for me at least, well, I was 10 when this happened, right? So I was like, oh, okay. Like, I got behind Brett, and it led me to ordering SummerSlam that year, or convincing my mom and dad to order SummerSlam. But I had my little brother, Brett had his little brother. And so that whole summer long feud with Owen, you know, watching the TV leading up to the SummerSlam match, it really was a big thing for me. And I thought it was well done. And then when Neidhart and Bulldog got involved after SummerSlam and then didn't get involved, another weird thing. And then Backlund, you know, that match, I think while it's tedious and I think they drew out the finish way too much, it's a good match. I thought it was at least very, you know, for Backlund especially, like going in there 40 minutes like he did, you know. But I don't know, like this is very much a nostalgia pick for me. And I think it's also indicative of us kind of having similar tastes in title reigns, because you guys picked the ones I was hoping would be there for me by the end. So,
go ahead. To that one is you have the great 1-2-3 kid match where he kind of completely makes this underdog guy look like a legit challenger. He's got the great Diesel match where Diesel can come out of nowhere and they have this great match. Plus all the awesome Owen matches. There's some really great tag matches too between Brett teaming with Davey Boy versus Owen and Neidhart. So there's a lot of great stuff in there too if you're looking for match quality to go along with storyline quality. So it's a really great reign. Bariqua.
Well, let's be honest. I'm going up against a Colossus here.
Yeah. And Brett's one of my favorite wrestlers, and everything Tim mentioned. There's also the 94 King of the Ring match with Diesel, which is also pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Very good match.
Yeah, but it's tough at least to go up against this juggernaut of a landmark reign of Hulk Hogan's first World Wrestling Federation Championship run. I mean, what can you say about a run that basically during the period where everything rose to another level, where things were transformed? I mean, it's a long reign. And it's Hogan before he settled into the formula, if first things first. I mean, he wrestled a lot of variety of opponents during this entire reign. It's the highest profile wrestling had ever gotten up to that point in several years. WrestleMania is established during this reign and is carried by Hogan as champion. You have the WrestleMania 3 versus Andre the Giant as the pinnacle of that era. And I mean,
and then the highest rated TV match of all time
The highest paid TV match where he lost it, at where he lost the title at the main event, yes. And I mean, it's a very historic and important reign overall to what the wrestling landscape was and turned into.
Yeah, and like as you said, Hogan before the formula, he was even like he was changing outfits. Like he didn't wear the yellow and red.
Right, the blue, the white.
Yeah.
He was like a draw, you know? Like, he changed the business. Like, and, like, you know, people talk about could Vince have put anyone in that role? No. You know? Like, maybe there are other people that could have done something. But Hogan was something. And, you know, you credit WrestleMania 1 to him. You credit WrestleMania 3 to him. Like, like an important title reign.
Yeah, and I think we've over argued for like three decades who's more important, what could have happened. They're symbiotic. It's none of them happens without the other. Yeah. You know?
It's chicken or the egg, basically.
Right. Yeah. Oh man, and so many good matches too. Like
against a variety of opponents. I mean, anywhere from of course Piper, Orndorff. You got Killer Khan and Kamala.
Oh, those are.
I mean. It's a wide variety of opponents.
Yeah. David Schultz, even.
Dr. D.
Yeah. Fuck. Yeah. Okay. Do we even have to vote on this, Matt?
No.
Okay. No. I mean, when I saw who was against kids, like, there's no chance. So, yeah. Sorry, Brett.
This one's tough. All right. So, we're going to go with Brian Danielson's Ring of Honor reign from 05-06 versus Asuka's NXT reign. Matt, do you want to go first?
Sure. If I was going to be able to make the case for any of these title reigns, it would be this one. I remember it so vividly. I was there for so much of it. So just to put a little bit of context, Bryan Danielson for the first 2.5 years of ROH was a legendary part of ROH and part of, you know, some of their best matches, but he was also sort of treated like a bit of a guest star. Like he would show up for a while, then he would disappear for a while, whether in Japan or Europe or whatever, and come in, have some great matches. People loved him. He was, you know, he was sort of a guest star. So Samojo's title reign is over. CM Punk has his farewell title run, great angle. Then Gabe goes to James Gibson, who had a really incredible year in ROH that year. Yeah. And so good that he very quickly got re-signed to WWE. And so as soon as he won the title, he was gone. So who does Gabe turn to? So Bryan Danielson, back from Europe, says, okay, I'm going to commit to ROH now. And he commits. And so Gabe puts him over James Gibson in a freaking – has anyone here seen that match? It's – fantastic.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but that finish is it's a hell of a match. It is for James's last match before he heads back. Like that, there are a few things he's done in his career better than that match.
Yeah, I agree. And it was not even like, you know, they it wasn't like a bomb throwing match. It wasn't like they spam near falls in any way. It was just a wrestling match, but like everything was perfect. And you know, it was a Long Island crowd, which, you know, at the time especially were notoriously quiet, and they got into this just straight ahead wrestling match, and it was just a fantastic way for Danielson to win the title. He gave this speech saying that he was going to stay as long as he held the title. He wasn't going to WWE, and he was going to defend the title. He defended James Gibson for leaving, you know, saying it was just really good. But up until that point, the knock on Bryan Danielson was fantastic wrestler, but not much in the way of personality, character. You know, he had his quirks, but he couldn't cut a promo, any of that stuff. So throughout the reign, especially the first few months, he gradually turned into this like subtle heel, where he grew some stubble. He started taunting the crowd. He had this like weird, almost like work shoot finish against Roderick Strong, where he was sort of a bully. And then by the end of – so this was September 2005 that he won the title. By the end of the year, he had this like kind of cocky bully attitude that no one had ever seen from Bryan Danielson before. So suddenly he was becoming this – he was growing into this full world champion persona. So he had this epic series with Roderick Strong. He had a really good match against Mara Fuji in his first match in ROH for Final Battle. you know, going into 2006, he had the really kind of the first match at the beginning of the CZW feud, because it was he basically – his storyline was he gave an open challenge to anybody. Chris Hero, who had never wrestled in ROH before, accepted it. That kicked off the CZW feud, even though he wasn't really much of a part of it. But he, over the next few months, had great matches with Jimmy Rave, with Alex Shelley. He had his series of matches with Nigel McGuinness, including the match in England, which everyone remembers as one of the great matches of the decade. He then wrestled against Colt Cabana in an hour-long match where he dislocated his shoulder in like the first couple of minutes, wrestled the rest of the hour, and then came back a month later and had what a lot of people still say is the best match in ROH history against Kenta at the Manhattan Center, the debut in the Manhattan Center. Had some a couple other hour-long matches, including one against Samoa Joe. He lost the title to Homicide in this epic match at the Manhattan Center. All the while, he developed into this like incredible heel champion character that the crowd loved like to hate, but it was okay because it was ROH. He was great at taunting the CZW crowd. He had great matches against Delirious. He had great matches against trying to think of what other matches that he had. He had a really good match, actually. Like it was like a three-way match with him and Jimmy Jacobs and BJ Whitmer. I can – like if I just went down the list, I can name pretty much every
title. He had the Necro match, right? Didn't he have a match against Necro or no?
Not during that.
Right? I might be imagining that one.
But you'll love this one. Not an ROH show, but right around the time he was having his match with Kenta at another smaller independent show, he went out of his way to defend the ROH title against – does anybody remember this?
Kamala. Yeah, I remember that. I bought that tape.
Yeah. So he did it all in that title reign and became one of the most entertaining characters, even promos in wrestling. And, of course, we see him now. He's just a great all-around performer in every single way. But – in terms of match quality, I don't know if it gets much better than this in the United States in a title reign. And in terms of like developing as a performer during your reign and growing into something legendary, I don't think it gets much better than this. To me, he was a Hall of Famer right after the end of this title reign. Like he didn't need to do anything else. And of course, he did plenty of other things after this. But I feel so lucky to have been at so many of these shows where he had so many of these matches. And got to see the whole thing from beginning to end.
I have till five, ref.
Yeah.
The cape, the beard. I mean,
yeah, the whole look.
Just go through it. I mean, it's wild to see what he looks like when he wins the belt, and then what he becomes by the final battle match. You know,
not just what he looks like, but how he acts.
Yeah, it's a complete 180. Like Homicide, who had gotten over in ROH with the fireball angle at Reborn, and it's like seen as this absolutely just dastardly heel. They turn him face against Danielson and have him win the damn belt. It's just like it's like I don't get how that happened, but what he did during that reign and who he made and when he made them and how many things happened for those people after he had matches with them. That's what I'm talking about. The importance here, man, there are some things that happened in this reign that still resonate today, 15 years later.
He even made a cameo in the Cage of Death match to be the biggest heel in the company, where he attacks Samoa Joe and he's like, I don't give a shit about this feud. I just want to keep my title, and I'm wrestling Joe next month. Like, right. I love that, too.
Oh, God.
All right. So a similar reign in a way that a character kind of started off one way and developed throughout the reign. But it's a different type of reign. It's more of a – so Asuka comes into NXT, and she's kind of built up as this, like, unbelievable force. And she just defeats everyone. And you know, this is the NXT when the women started to become the most important thing. Sasha was the champion, and she ended up dropping it to Bayley. And you know, Bayley had a pretty good reign too, but then she faced Asuka at WrestleMania weekend, and you know, it was a great match, and Asuka destroyed her, right? Yeah. And then and it's like Asuka starts off as just like, you know, she's a nice person. And, you know, she's having these competitive matches. She's just really badass. And she faces, like, monsters, like Nia Jax had a takeover. She has another great match.
That match was so good.
Yeah. She has another great match with Bayley at a takeover. Then she moves on in Toronto. I was there live facing the returning hero, Mickey James. She also destroys some TV matches. She has to face a takeover. They don't have a fucking challenger for her. They have to bring on three people. She faced the Iconics and Nikki Cross and destroys them all. You know, on TV more, she has more matches. She has a great match with Ember Moon on a takeover. She had that little mini feud against Nikki Cross and Ruby Riott, where they had a couple three-way matches before the last woman standing match against Nikki Cross, which is unbelievable. And then, you know, Ember Moon got another one in Brooklyn to face Asuka, and she got destroyed. And Asuka's was so fucking dominant. It's so awesome as a champion. You know, they're throwing two people, three people at her. No one can beat her. They're bringing back fucking legends because they have no one can even hold a candle to her. That, you know, she goes to the main roster and just like, I'm bigger. I've expanded way fucking bigger than the title. And she just hands it over and remains undefeated for, I think, for another year until Charlotte. But like through that whole lane, she started off as just like, you know, she's a badass and she's cool and stuff. She started to get more and more cocky. She was having like promos at a pool, I remember, where she was just like beating up like pool hands as this arrogant like person, and she became so overconfident and so dominant. Like it was such a just like a special reign that you don't see very often. It's just like, here is someone who is so fucking great that no matter what you do, you can't beat her. I loved it. It's very awesome to me.
First off, fuck the fact that this is a first round matchup. This is absolutely just asinine. I can't believe this is a first round matchup. second off, two things. The two biggest things I take away with this. First off, people forget Asuka was not supposed to go to the main roster.
Correct.
The whole thing coming in was that because of her skill set, they weren't going to make her a coach, but they basically were like, you're going to help make these women step their game up to a point that they haven't been before. And she ended up coming in at the same time that essentially four women were ascendant. Yeah. And she was better than all of them essentially from the get-go. And the second part about this is the fact that she never dropped the title. They didn't have her drop the title. And that's insane in modern wrestling. That somebody just, you know what? I'm done. It's over. It's so hilarious that they tried to do that with the War Raiders.
Yeah.
And it people were just kind of like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
But then like Asuka does it and it's like, poof, you know? So there is a modern importance. So both of these reigns are similar in that they both happened, and the people that interacted with both of these champions, their careers were made – the majority of them were made better for it. And that's what's going to be difficult for me to pick between these two, is because who was influenced by these reigns, who was made by these reigns, who got opportunities because of these reigns, who was made – like, there's a lot here that it's kind of difficult to choose between the two.
Rico, we haven't heard from you.
In my case, the fact that she didn't – that Asuka didn't lose the title actually kind of is a little bit of a blip on the fantastic reign she had. It's the second time they did it in NXT, because they also did that with Paige when she went up to the main roster. She didn't lose it either. They had her vacated.
Kind of different circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely different. With Asuka, I think I remember that they were trying to first work maybe an injury angle at first near the end of the reign, and I think they ended up just having her vacated because she was just, you know, moving on up.
And they brought the whole roster to the stage.
Yeah.
And like gave her this like, you know, big farewell, like, yeah, you are fucking too good for us. You have to leave and face better competition, because you're too dominant and too awesome for us. You are a god, Asuka. We love you. That's how it ended. Like, what a better way to end a title reign.
It's tough because I can't add much more than it's already been said. I mean, Matt just the Matt and Tim just basically laid out the entire love letter to that Danielson reign, and then Steven here just laid out beautifully the Asuka reign. So it's much more eloquent than my Hogan title reign explanation.
Well, you didn't need to argue yet.
So. Yeah, I know, but it's tough. It's a tough one. I'm leaning towards one at the moment. And I don't know if we're gonna be voting now or.
Well, let's see. Let Tim have a vote right now. We'll see kind of where we're sitting.
All right.
So I'm gonna pick Danielson. It's close, but I'm gonna pick Danielson. Even though I was gonna pick Asuka, it's like the Danielson reign is like, it's underrated. Like I don't get why people don't talk about this reign. And
well, it ties into the fact also that during that time when the wrestling of Serato influence, he really wasn't watching this and rating it in the newsletter. So that's part of why it's underrated as well.
Well, remember a lot of people were kind of wondering. And Matt brought this up when he was talking about the fact that Brian came back, was that Brian was in such high demand, and especially with what happened with Punk and what happened with Joe and what happened with Loki, that with him working New Japan and him working Europe, like the people were just wondering, it's like, how long was it going to be until, he decided to, take his ball to a bigger arena. And he stuck around ROH for 5 more years.
Yeah.
This title reign that I think we's like, you know what? Let's do it. Let's see what happens. And it turned out to be one of the biggest things he ever did because, like Matt said, that led directly to the Nigel stuff. That led directly or indirectly, however you want to see it, to the Morishima feud. And it's like – all these things that came because of this and his decision to do this reign, I think the reverberations of that have steadfastly gotten better and better with age. Whereas as much as I like the Oscar reign, how much it represented kind of the zenith of the women professionally being presented in the WWE.
There's not a lot there for me right now. It's also worth noting that during this reign, he became, at least in a lot of the online community, the consensus pick for best wrestler in the world at that moment.
Mm-hmm. This starts the streak, right? Doesn't this start the streak, essentially, of the Outstanding Wrestler Awards? And he just rattles them off, I'm pretty sure, after the
year. Well, anyone who didn't vote Asuka Wrestler of the Year during her title reign was wrong. So
you might be right.
I don't know about this consensus stuff, like – there's consensus right now that I don't agree with. So, Asuka was the best wrestler in the world during her reign too. And fuck, look at her now too. Oh, I wish if we did this a little bit later, Kabuki Warriors, that might have been a pick too. that's something. I think I don't stand a chance here. I think
the Danielson reign is more important to the company it happened in. Based on that, I think that would be that edges it for Danielson. And in my particular case, it's the fact that Asuka didn't drop the title that kind of – I know it kind of sticks at me a little bit that she just vacated it.
Now, I will – in her defense at that point – there was nobody for her to lose to. Ember Moon, everybody was talking about she should have lifted it at WrestleMania weekend, and it's just like she just wasn't there yet.
Yeah,
and
they should have gave – there was no one to drop the title to because she was too fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just – but
it is
but,
what it man, is. I know.
It is. It is what it is. It just sucks. But man, Danielson, phew, boy.
Yeah.
I'm glad we're going to get to talk about it a little bit more, for sure.
Yeah, that's going to be one heck of a conversation in the next round, I'll tell you that.
we'll get to it. But, Tim, why don't you...
Oh, boy. Matt, you and I are going to have a discussion here. So, in a lot of people's minds, these are mirror image reigns. from business standpoint, match quality standpoint.
Let's see what the matchup is. I guess people listening along might not be able to follow.
So the matchup is so it's Kenta Kobashi's JHC title reign from 2003 to 2005 to the fourth IWGP heavyweight title reign of Kazuchika Okada from 2016 to 2018. But look, so both of them 2 years, both of them double digit defenses, both of them major Tokyo Dome defenses that highlighted the reigns, major houses drawn against invading foreigners. But I, like I said, I think the biggest thing that this the GHC title reign has going for it is that I don't think there is a title reign that has defined a pro wrestler more than this title reign has. Like, for all the things that I came to know and love about Kenta Kobashi, even though I don't think of him in the same regards as the other four pillars, it's hard for me not to say, oh, that guy, he's a great professional wrestler. I love what he did in All Japan. Like, I loved his tag title reigns. I loved what he was as Misawa second during the high days of the Misawa Kawada rivalry. And that's what I knew him as. And then he has this title reign where he comes back from a knee injury that people didn't expect for him to wrestle ever again. You know, walking was, you know, talked about, like he was going to have difficulty walking. And he comes out and he finally gets the big match win over Misawa, and then from there, he defines what that title is after essentially 2 years of it kind of people not knowing what to expect with it. Like, Misawa kind of had it. It was kind of back and forth. Akiyama's title reign, which I think the company was hoping was going to be a big deal, it kind of flopped, and so went back to Misawa. So when Kobashi beats Misawa definitively – in that incredible match in March of 2003, that is like, if that's how it starts, how do you keep that going? And at what point does it become, you know, the next launching pad? And for what it's worth, Noah did what they could within those next 2 years to figure out, you know what, we need to set this up for somebody. And I think the biggest argument against this, because we're going to get to it, is how it ended and who it ended it to. And that's, I think, why a lot of people are just kind of like, well, why couldn't it have been Morishima? And as we found out, it was because Morishima wasn't ready yet. And it took him a couple years, and it took him, surprise, surprise, Bryan Danielson, to make him into the Morishima that everybody wanted.
Yeah, and he might not have actually ever been truly ready.
Correct. And now, with hindsight, he probably was never the guy. But, I mean, match quality, the Takayama match, the Minoru Suzuki match, the Akira Taue match, the Nagata match. Like, let's go through these. It's like, it's a who's who of professional wrestling in Japan at the time. The Akiyama Noah match, which is not my favorite between the two of them, but still a tremendous match. He even has like the Yoshinari Ogawa match, which is – that match had never been as good as it was, and it is fantastic. And it also sets up Ogawa's title win a few years later, which I think was just phenomenal. The Tomon Honda match that starts it, the match of Honda's career. The Mike Awesome match where they have a fucking FMW match in the Budokan, and it's like really fucking good. The Akitoshi Saito match where he takes that ridiculous bump on the apron. You know, the match, he like killed himself in these 2 years. Like, what he does to his body when he shouldn't be, considering what he's had to work from or work back from, is just insane. And like I said, I think the only thing, and this is where I think if you think about how the title reign should go from start to finish, is like a lot of people hold that finish against him in a way, but what else were you supposed to do other than get Misawa back into it? And Riccio was paving his way, and it was a big deal when he won, and then soon after, it was – that was pretty much the decline. And I think there's some – unfortunately, there's kind of an argument against that, and in the sense that, you know, Noah made the decision when they did, who they did it with, and ended what was this incredible title reign with Takeshi Riccio, who became one of the biggest flop title reigns in the history of Japanese pro wrestling. That's hard to rectify. And there's a lot of people, especially then, who are like, why the fuck did they do this? And I think it's still kind of one of those things now, 15 years later, where people are like, why the fuck did they do this? But at the same time, the 2 years that led up to that are almost undeniable. And, you know, it's not just the in-ring work. It is where it put Noah. They ran the dome because they put the belt on Kobashi. There's reasons why they were able to do what they did during the Kobashi title reign. And it is as important a title reign perhaps to a company standing than maybe any other one on this list other than the Hogan reign. And that's how big that title reign was for Noah. And, you know, shit happens obviously after that, but man, when it was in the moment, there was very few things that was wrong with it.
All right, Matt, are you going to argue for a title reign I haven't seen a single match from?
Yeah, I guess I am. This is a tough one because I mean, I would have picked that Kobashi reign if you hadn't, Tim. So I, you know, much respect, but I will definitely make the case for Okada here. This was his fourth title reign. He had definitely had other pretty important reigns. So this reign, I would say, was not as important as Kobashi's. It didn't really put this title on the map, obviously, nor did it put Okada as a champion on the map. He was already well established. But in terms of length, in terms of it being an important era, in terms of matches, I mean, you got the Kenny Omega matches, right? He had three, right? Including the match that he lost the title to Omega. Whatever you think about the matches, a lot of people think that they're among the best matches of all time, whether you agree or not. It's worth noting that people think that. But there was also the Shibata match, which, you know, maybe has sort of a tarnished legacy because of what happened to Shibata. But wow, what a match. Zack Sabre, a great match with him. He had another really good match with Tanahashi during this reign. He had a match with Marufuji that was really good. Had a Wrestle Kingdom match with Naito that was really good. Had a great match against Minoru Suzuki that was really good. Just big match after big match that, at least for that audience, delivered. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like he was really the standard bearer in an era where people were paying a lot of attention to New Japan. And I mean, this is really – for me, this reign is all about the matches and kind of keeping the gravy train going. And he did both in an epic way. Like I said, I can't say that it was world-changing the way that Kobashi's was. But in terms of just consistent quality, in terms of getting a lot of eyes on you and succeeding in that role, in terms of memorable matches that people are going to watch years later, this reign had them. And it was the reign that I picked from all of this modern New Japan IWGP title era.
Yeah. And how many title reigns have a 6-star, a 6.25, and 6.75-star matches in it?
7 stars. Wasn't one of them 7?
Wasn't them a 7? Holy fuck! Yeah. That doesn't happen. So
literally has never happened.
So yeah, exactly.
Me personally. The Wrestle Kingdom 11 decision is almost indefensible.
That's the one Naito didn't win?
Yeah,
I don't watch, and I knew that was epic.
So look, that's kind of the thing for me was that everything about that reign. So, and this is the decision that Gato made. So, so this is the double-edged sword about this reign. Everything Matt just said is so right on the money, and then some, because you get to weave in Omega, and while that's happening, open yourself up to Western audiences for the first time with NJBW World at full throttle. And it works, right? From a business perspective, it is a huge boon for that company. It makes them come west for the first time. It makes them feel like, you know what? If we put our power behind Omega, we are going to do that. And so that's why that decision, when Naito had been building to that moment for all that time, at the same time, right? It's that idea of, you know, and we talk about this with WWF friends all the time, that rise organically of how much Naito meant to legitimately how much Okada and Omega's work together drew business for New Japan outside of the country, how much that was important to it. And I think if you are okay with Naito losing, that reign is an all-timer. If you aren't, like I am, it's difficult. But it is I do think that regardless of what you think about Okada's match style, there's a lot of things about his reign that are just undeniable.
I don't dislike Okada or any of those guys. It's just not my thing. I will go with the crowd on this one. Do you have any say on this one?
No, I don't have a strong thought per se, because these are two reigns that I haven't seen too much of in my case. So, but I do agree that with Tim's point that the way they didn't stick the landing with the Okada reign. I mean, it kind of blew up in their face because it was supposed to, you know, they kind of stuck Naito with the loss, and then they went with Omega, and Omega ended up basically bailing when they were hoping to do the MSG show with him. So I'm more in line with Steven in that Okada style. I can respect everything it's accomplished, but it's not actually my cup of tea. I much prefer Kobashi of the two reigns.
If this was matched up against most of the other reigns, I would be pick harder. But even I'm going to vote for Kobashi here.
No, that's a very fair point. That the Okada's reign against quite a few of these others would be deserving to move on. But this particular matchup, it's a little harder to really get excited to push for Okada's reign over Kobashi.
They're so similar, but.
But yeah. One's better.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's like – so there's a caveat here. So this reign ends in a way that both of these title reigns ended weirdly, right? What they thought at the time was the best thing for business, because literally everything building up to that point where they made the decision for the title reign to end, right? Rikyo was the best non-Akiyama, Misawa, Tawe, Kobashi ascendant. And he had been building something up, so he was the guy.
Yeah, it just didn't work out.
And that's the thing. It's like, in retrospect, you 100% can paint that brush. It's like, man, like, why didn't they just let Naito win then? But I do think that it was going to be difficult to not pay off Kenny finally winning the title without him beating Okada.
Yeah, and they didn't know what was going to happen a few months anyway afterwards when they did the decision.
Cody Rhodes politicked the hell into like that. I mean, that's a big – people – the three months between Omega winning and All In, boy, like the world of wrestling changed for forever in those 3 months. Absolutely changed forever.
So. All right. Let's move on. I think Kenta Kobashi moves on. We can all agree, but that's one of the tougher first round matchups. There's been some tough first round matchups. Fuck. This is another tough one. We got Hogan's NWO first title reign from 96 to 97, and Carlos Colon's his fifth reign.
Yeah, it's his fifth reign of the Universal title.
From 86 to 87, so.
Yeah, September of 86 to about July of 87.
Okay. And there's a lot of great things in that, but let me get to my case here.
Okay.
Oddly, it goes from August to August, Road Wild to Road Wild, so that's pretty cool. Or no, Road Wild to the Nitro before Road Wild. in 97 for Hogan. But I think what makes this reign stand out is it's kind of the blueprint of a heel with a stable of cronies to defend himself having a reign. So that part's kind of fascinating. Cause it like, you know, look at things like the Bullet Club and things like, Triple H's Evolution and that kind of stuff. It's, they're trying to copy Hogan's NWO reign here. And not only that, you got Hogan, the most beloved babyface of all time, who we talked about his earlier reign as one of the most important reigns of all time. And here he just turns his heel in, July, a month before, at Bash and Beach. And here he is a month later, redefining his career as a heel for the first time since, what, 81, 82, something like that, and having one of the most iconic title reigns of all time as a heel. So he bends it from Giant at Road Wild, actually a pretty decent match. Clash of the Champions versus Blair. I don't remember that, but whatever. The Savage Halloween Havoc stuff's really good. There's the Piper thing at Starrcade that is weird, but not a title match. But it's part of the reign kind of thing. I don't know what to say about that part. He faces the Giant in like the 70-minute match that goes during Robin Hood and on pay-per-view. He faces Piper at the Super Bowl when Piper's locked in Alcatraz. And then it goes all the way to facing Luger on like the I think the 100th Nitro in like a very special moment. But obviously this match is not built on reigns or a bit built on matches. It's built on, the overarching story, the drawing power. Like this was the biggest company in the world at the time and it was due to the NWO. And every week Hogan would come out there. He would come out there and he would talk about being the wrestling god and he fucking spray painted the title with the NWO symbol on it. Something that was, like, unheard of at the time. They kind of, like, redefined wrestling. And he was the man in that. I think it wasn't something that immediately came to mind, but when I started to think about it, this is one of the most special world title reigns of, like, any company. And it was during the biggest period with, like, one of the biggest stars on top. So I think this one's pretty good.
Whew. Wow.
That's... Yep.
Okay. I'll hold my thoughts, but...
All right.
Yeah, let's say it's like, let's go. Let's see what he's got. Hold on. All
right, so I'm on then. All right. Well, let's talk about Carlos Colon's fifth Universal title reign. And I think... For this, I need to set up exactly how it starts, this particular reign itself. This is September 21st, 1986. This is Aniversario 1986 weekend. The Universal title is vacant at this point in time. It's vacant because the former holder of the title, which happened to be one Carlos Colon, oddly enough, back in April, there was a six-man tag match between Carlos, the Invader 1, Invader 3, against Chicky, Star, Ron Star, and Abdullah Butcher, where Abdullah the Butcher threw ammonia in Carlos Colon's face and blinded him.
Okay, first off, we're talking. Let's go. Let's go.
So, you can probably – so because of this heinous act, Carlos Colon lost his sight and had to vacate the Universal title. And it was feared he would never be able to wrestle again, and you know, and so forth. And Chicky Starr was gloating about this. And then miraculously, a couple of months later, Colon's vision returned. He came back, had his big revenge match against Abdullah the Butcher, which if anybody's seen it, it's Venganza al-Tales. It's the match that goes like 20 minutes where Carlos Colon just beats the hell out of Abdullah the Butcher without Abdullah the Butcher basically getting no offense in. For like 20 minutes.
I love that.
And then afterwards, after doing the revenge against Abdullah, the revenge against Chicky, Aniversario weekend comes along. And for the first time, they decide that they're going to do it a three-day event, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And 4.5 months since it was vacated, the Universal title was still vacant. So they decided that they were gonna have a tournament. A tournament to decide Universal Champion. An 8-man field. And this isn't just – listen to this 8-man field. First round was Bruiser Brody versus Rick Martel. Giant Baba versus Abdullah the Butcher. Giant Baba was in Puerto Rico for this, for the Universal title tournament.
Wow.
Barry Windham versus Terry Funk.
Oh, shit.
And Carlos Colon versus – well, Boris Sukhov. You can't win them all. One of these things is not like the others. So Colon's path to the title was as follows. This is the tournament field. He beats Boris Sukhov in the first round. He defeats Abdullah the Butcher, his hated rival, in the second round. And then the finals is against Terry Funk. And he defeats Terry Funk to be crowned the Universal Champion and regain the title he had vacated. During the finals of the match, Dory Funk tries to interfere on behalf of his brother but fails. And because of that, guess who the first challenger for Colon's title is? Dory Funk Jr. First title defense. The week after that, we get another Texan come into Puerto Rico, Stan Hansen. And this is the beginning of the famous Stan Hansen-Carlos Colon feud from 1986 to 1987.
All-time fucking classic.
Yeah. Second time that they faced off against each other. In 84, they had already had a tag feud between Brody Hansen and Carlos and several partners. But this is when the Hansen feud starts. So it's a series of matches that extends from basically October mid-October to mid-March. And not only is this series taking place, which, you know, starts with the different matches where it looks like Hansen won the title, but the decision was reversed because of outside interference. So technically, it's still one reign. But not only is that happening while this is – for those of you who have seen Puerto Rican wrestling or have seen the DVD VR 80 sets and all that's been done, during this time that Stan Hansen is – the feud is going on, a new mystery wrestler shows up by the name of TNT, also known as Savio Vega to most other people, along with his manager. This absolutely mysterious new wrestler shows up and starts appearing on TV doing squashes, and he basically wants to challenge Colon for the Universal title. And they have a TV studio match that ends up with TNT laying out Colon with his Cobra hold, leaving him completely out. And they refuse to wake him up. And Colon basically is out foaming at the mouth, and they're desperately trying to revive him and wake him up because TNT refused to revive him. You know that old – you know that one where you have to hit the nerves in order to wake him up? So while he's feuding with Hansen, he's also feuding with TNT over that. So you stretch this out from a period of about November to about – February, where he's feuding with TNT. He feuds with Hansen, which includes the Fantastic Bull Rope match and the Fantastic Cage match near the end, which is – it's amazing. It's escape rules, and it's – I always say this. If you think escape rules match aren't – you know, if you don't like escape rules match, watch Colon versus Hansen and see how escape rules should be worked. Throughout the entire match, Hansen tries to escape. Colon only escapes, tries to make an escape once when he's absolutely sure that he's done with Hansen. When this feud is over, he has several other challenges. He faces off against Jason the Terrible, Chicky Starr, and other wrestlers that Chicky brings. The capper to this entire reign is around mid-April. Something happens that had hardly happened before in Puerto Rican wrestling. A top face, a top técnico, Hércules Ayala, turned heel and turned his back on the Justice Army, turning heel and challenging Colon for the Universal title, which sets off another feud. And I don't know if you've seen this. Colon ends up losing the title in a death match. If you've seen it, it's the one where Ayala and Colon are wrestling, where Colon is laid out in an absolute hideously bloody mess, and the referee has to stop the match. And that's where the title reign ends. That particular title reign.
God, so, do I vote for Barikwa just on the story?
So, like, to me, I think I would rather watch. I would definitely rather watch Cologne's Reign. It sounds more fun. It has way more great matches.
Good business as well. Hot business.
It did hot business, but you're talking business, baby. You're talking the NWO in 96, 97 with Hogan on top. And, you know, it's a career-defining reign, even though he's already had, like, it's his second Hall of Fame title reign, which is kind of crazy. The matches aren't really great. He does these long-ass promos. He's like the most hateable man on the planet.
He takes vacations and disappears.
He refuses to defend the title on television. He wears a fucking wig when he's making a kid's ninja movie during a match, which I love. That's like one of my favorites.
Yeah, that was Havoc against Savage. Havoc 96.
That was great shit. So, like, I'm going with the importance, the money, the historical significance, the Hall of Fame quality argument, not the not the match quality, not the storytelling. I'm going like awesome indie film versus big important like
thing. Michael Bay Transformers is what it's going up against, is what you're saying.
yeah. So I don't know, Matt. I don't think we've heard from you.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly watched the Hogan Reign a lot at the time. It was a big deal for me. That storyline was huge. The Sting angle was something I was
completely – I didn't even fucking mention the Sting angle. Shit. Yeah.
It was something I was completely wrapped up in. Like, it captivated me until it didn't. You know what I mean? That said, the matches were bad. And I haven't seen much of this Carlos Colon reign, but man, did Barikwa do a good job explaining that or what?
And the Hansen matches are all-time classics.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen the bull rope match, and that alone is kind of like, I don't know if there's anything Hogan did that touches that.
There's no great Hogan match in this reign.
There's none.
Agent the Cage.
Yeah.
That's after, you're right.
That's after. We can't hold that against it.
I'm going to vote for Cologne. Sorry.
Sorry, I'm voting for Cologne too. I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that I don't know if there's a more important Puerto Rican title reign for business, for who gets involved, for Cologne was still the top technico, but I think this is kind of like, Barikwa, you could probably speak to it more, but this is like the part that started really making Carlos Colon a true legend around this time. Like, his legend was basically being built during these mid-80s runs that he had.
Yeah, it's you got to remember, I mean, this is Colon since about 81, 82. He had been consistently taking to the limit Harley Race and Ric Flair in the quest to become the NWA champion and basically become the Universal Champion, because it was champion versus champion, who was the better, who was the best. And yeah, by this point, I mean, just listen to that field they got for the tournament. Boris Sukov aside, I mean, that is, you know, that is an amazing, amazing collection of wrestlers to appear in the tournament. And then just to have it amazes me that the TNT feud that initially, that if you've never seen that angle, it's just absolutely nuts. When he's foaming at the mouth and everybody freaking out. That happening concurrently with the absolute craziness of Hansen, of the Hansen feud as well. I mean, it's amazing. And then the importance of how it actually dovetails this reign into the first big main star that turns heel, Puerto Rican star that turns heel, because yes, you had Cheeky, yes, but these guys were more lower mid-carders that turned into more managers/wrestlers. But this was the first top guy to turn heel. So that in itself is also a pretty historical aspect of this reign as well.
man, I can't wait to argue Kobashi versus Cologne in the next round. But
now that's different.
That's gonna be fun. so next up, we got Samoa Joe's Ring of Honor reign versus Orange Cassidy's Independent Wrestling Television title reign, Independent Champion reign. So. I think we all know how this will end, so I'm just going to make a little bit of case for the freshly squeezed one, Orange Cassidy. So, this reign, this is a reign that I followed very, very closely at the time, from December of 2018 all the way to May of 2019. So, it starts off actually... I'm going to include this is the number one contenders match for this before the title reign starts, but the match that determines that Orange Cassidy gets a title shot, because it's perhaps my favorite match of all time, and that's David Starr, who's obviously, you know, a big star in the independent scene, you know, a legit great wrestler, one of the aces of Beyond Wrestling. This is where this match takes place against Orange Cassidy, who... up to that point, was a loser jobber on the undercard who didn't try during matches. This match is on YouTube. Everyone go search Orange Cassidy versus David Starr. It is, like, everyone saw the Pac versus Orange Cassidy match. This match is a way, way, way better version of it. It's so great. And Orange Cassidy pulls out a fluke win with a roll-up in it. It's outstanding. So he gets the title shot against Tracy Williams, who was a great champion, at Beyond, and ends up fucking beating him at New Year's Eve in 2018. So from there, in a big upset, because Tracy Williams, you know, he was one of the ants, and he was going to, I think, Ring of Honor after this. He was the guy that people tout. So Orange Cassidy, from there, defends the title in 11 promotions. Dude fucking travels. He carried the title in the duffel bag. Some of the matches were, you know, a couple seconds of him going in the ring and then pulling out a quick little victory. Some of the real standouts is beating Eddie Kingston in St. Louis. St. Louis Anarchy, which was a great thing. Chris Dickinson victory that was surprising. You know, he faced John Silver, Tom Lawler, he was able to defeat. One of the first, he went to Darren Corbin's, went to First Wrestling and faced Darren Corbin and ended up beating him. That was an impromptu match, I remember that. He had a European rounds match against Jonathan Gresham and was able to roll him up and defeat him 2-0. 2-0. He defeated Brian Alvarez. He defeated Kylie Rae in a great match. He defeated Jordan Grace. He had an awesome match at ICW against Joey Janela before he ended up dropping the title to Chris Statlander. Right when she was breaking out and becoming a star, in a very great match that really put her over the top. And this reign had comedy. It had Orange Cassidy growing. It had him doing his shtick in 11 different promotions. He would show up with his little duffel bag and pull out the title and sometimes defend it with gusto and sometimes... defend it with, I think, sloth style is how Excalibur is saying it, because I watched one of the AEW matches the other day for the first time. So, yeah, Orange Cassidy, this reign, really, really loved it. I thought it was super important. It really put the IWTV independent title on the map, really made people realize that Orange Cassidy was way more than just a comedy dude. I really love this shit. It's all on independentwrestling.tv if you want to go check it out. And some of it's on YouTube, so I highly suggest it. But he's facing Samoa Joe's Ring of Honor reign, so I don't know. There isn't much I can say. Matthew.
Well, thank you, because I didn't know a lot of that. So I will check that out on YouTube. It's, I love Orange Cassidy, so I should probably love that reign. Like I said, I've been rewatching this entire Samoa Joe title reign as part of my podcast. You can check it out at this very same podcast network. He won the title in March of 2003 at a time when he would not have been the expected person to be the ROH champion. Now, at the same time, neither would the man he beat, which was Xavier. Low-key was the first ROH champion. Everyone expected that. He was sort of the ROH's first big star, had a run of matches that first year that was pretty legendary. People were shocked when he lost it to Xavier. It was a very, you know, now we can see it's a very Gabe Sapolsky move to do something that subverts everyone's expectations. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think in retrospect, the Xavier title reign was better than a lot of people give it credit for, but it's not a great title reign, and it wasn't seen as such, especially at the time. Samoa Joe came in as, you know, kind of like a one-off to have this incredible hard-hitting match with Low-Ki at the first Glory by Honor. And then he was sort of like almost like this just this badass guy that would be, you know, that would be around, have matches, but he was never positioned as like one of the top guys in the company. And in fact, later on during his title reign, there was a promo with him and Steve Corino where Corino was like, "You were supposed to be the enforcer. I was supposed to be the world champion." Like, it was sort of, and it's true. Like, that's what made sense. But they put the title on him, and within a couple months, he had his first really great title defense against Homicide at a show called Do or Die, the very first one, where it was just like a bomb-throwing match where they were dropping each other off the, you know, like backdrop drivers and muscle busters off the top rope. That was when Samoa Joe debuted that move. You know, there was a big storyline involving Low-Ki firing up Homicide. Just a great match. And from that moment on, Samoa Joe had this style. It was his 2003 world title match style, where it was short matches, fast-paced, hard-hitting, brutal, and he would win pretty dominantly. And that was his style for that year. By the end of that year, he had a couple of matches where it looked like he might lose, one against Christopher Daniels in particular, but all of his matches were short and hard-hitting. I believe Homicide beat him in a non-title match, but he was dominant. And during that time, he was sort of like not a face or a heel. Like, he was he didn't slap the fans' hands. He was kind of a dick to, you know, to certain characters, but he was very well respected. 2004, the whole big change came, the RF scandal, all that stuff, and Samoa Joe's title reign developed. He had this unbelievable cage match against Jay Briscoe. It's called a show called At Our Best. It's our longest episode if anyone wants to go back and listen to it. Just still one of my favorite cage matches. Jay Briscoe was a bleeding mess. It was amazing. And from that moment on, at the end, he showed respect to the Briscoes. And from then on, he was a total babyface. Slapping the hands, he debuted the Champ Is Here as his theme music. Went into this feud with Homicide, who turned into this like crazy heel. And that took him to a new level. Then he had the feud with CM Punk. Two 60-minute draws that Dave Meltzer, back to him again, went crazy over, which got lots of people to start buying ROH DVDs that had never before. He gave their second match in October 5 stars, which was the first match in America to get 5 stars in the Observer since the first Hell in a Cell, which is that's like 7 years. In between, again, now it throws him around for any old Johnny Gargano match. It's just one incredible match after another. The character developed, the promotion just got so many more eyeballs on it during this era. He actually had a match against Danielson in 2004 that's possibly one of the most, in my opinion, underrated matches ever. I feel like that's close to as good as the Punk matches. He had another really ridiculously great match against Punk at the end of the year that he won. People expected Punk to beat him. I see, Steven, that you already put Samoa Joe as the winner. But I'll continue making my case anyway. This really legendary match against Punk where he beat him very unexpectedly. So just it wasn't an hour long draw, so like people were shocked at the finish. And then he finally lost it to Austin Aries, which some people you know, maybe aren't happy about in retrospect, but I thought it was a great move at the time. Aries was ready. It was a great match. It was shocking. It started a new era of ROH. So I thought the reign began kind of unassumingly, But it ended in a really spectacular way. And throughout the entire reign, ROH just grew in profile. You know, there were definitely dips because of that scandal, you know, where attendance went down dramatically. But it built back up again, mostly thanks to Samoa Joe. He made that belt feel like the most important belt in the world, and this was an indie company, you know, and that's hard to do. So we were talking earlier about belts that make the wrestler and wrestlers that make the belt. Samoa Joe made the ROH world title. It was nothing. No offense to Xavier. It was nothing before he had it. It was everything by the time he lost it.
Sorry,
go ahead.
It's, yeah.
You could make the same case for Orange Cassidy.
There was a kind of a breakup.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to – basically what I ended by saying was that that belt was nothing before Joe had it. It was everything by the time he lost it. And it was one of the most coveted belts in the country for a while after that. Yeah. Maybe not so much anymore. But it also put long title reigns back on the map in America, right? It happened concurrently with Kobashi's. I'm sure it was in part inspired by that. But – But after that, WWE, like you said, John Cena started having long reigns. ROH had a lot of long reigns, right? Danielson and Nigel had the belts for over a year. So it was a big deal reign, and it was great too. Like, it was really important and really fucking good. And Samoa Joe became another one guy who's like, you could say he was the best wrestler of the world for part of that time. Or certainly in the country. So don't get that too often. And that's all I got to say.
It's tough. This is a tough call. Burik, what were you saying?
I don't think I can add anything else to what Matt just said. I mean, I'll take note of the Orange Cassidy matches you mentioned, because I do enjoy watching Orange Cassidy. And also shout out to IWTV, our friends over there. But you already know this is a foregone conclusion.
I know.
Yeah.
Timmy, do you have anything to say before we move on?
No. I have a feeling we're going to be talking more about the Joe Reign later. So.
Everyone watch the David Starr match. It's fucking.
It's a great match.
Yeah. And the Gresham match where they go European rules at WrestleMania weekend is something else. All right, let's move on. We got Mitsuhara Misawa's 92 to 94 reign and John Cena's 06-07 reign. Both of these guys, iconic best reigns of their careers. This is something I want to hear from. So, Tim, why don't you make your argument?
Okay, so I've definitely talked at length about Misawa's ascension to become the replacement for Jumbo, essentially, in the 1990s in All Japan on a couple other podcasts. But the title reign, I think, like I've talked about when I mentioned it for the bracket, I think it 100% gets kind of lost in the shuffle about how important that title reign was for not just establishing Misawa's standing, but as we've talked about with some of these other reigns, how those other people that he faces throughout this title reign get involved and where their standings are throughout. And so, you know, he beats Stan Hansen with the running elbow, and immediately it becomes like a kill shot move. It becomes one of the biggest moves in his arsenal. And when that happens, he had just beaten Jumbo with the face lock in a tag match. He had established himself as this guy that had figured out how to take on the biggest stars of the company at that point, and he is the champ. And so his first title defense is against his tag team partner at the time, in Toshiaki Kawada. It's a very good match. I think that compared to what people kind of came to be used to by their standards down the road, it's not as great, but it gives you an idea, especially when he won the title, of just how much higher in the pecking order he was even than Kawada. And so then in 1993, when Kawada and Misawa lose the tag titles, and after the Real World Tag League decide to go their separate ways, and with Jumbo essentially retiring or being brought down the card, Taui becomes available as a tag partner, and so Kawada joins him, and then Misawa and Kobashi team up. And from there, it gets established that Misawa is going to be that have to be the guy that you go through. And a lot of people think about the tag team matches in this setting, but I mean, the matches he had throughout this entire reign against Hansen in a rematch, against Kawada twice, against Taue, you know, who he was able to establish this reign against and build himself up to become the ace of the promotion, and him getting past a year and then getting through the Champions Carnival after Hansen wins it. And how does he kind of hold on to this title that people thought for a long time, you know, somebody's going to take it, because the Triple Crown at that point had never really been more than a prop. It hadn't had a really long title reign before. And so here he is, and he holds it for nearly 2 years. And the only thing that really stops him is the deadliest move in the company, which is the homicidal backdrop driver of Steve Williams. And you can avoid it once, but you can't avoid it twice. But of course, the thing that defines this reign is what happens on June 3rd, 1994. And what is perhaps one of the funniest things in retrospect, considering what happened with Williams and what ended up happening with Kawada, because of the fact it was the third time he had faced Misawa during this title reign, was a lot of people thought that that should have been the end, that putting Kawada over should have been the ending point of it. But of course it wasn't. And I think what's interesting about it is, even though a lot of people are upset that Kawada ends up losing, it's that the Misawa reign basically comes down to, it takes a move presented as almost death, you know, death Lee, to finally put him down. And I can't really think of a title reign that defined perhaps a person standing in the company, especially with what happened the rest of the decade, more than that title reign. It made him not just the star of the company, but the true ace, the true person to build the company around until the split in 2000. And, you know, Baba deciding to have that long title reign the way he did, especially after, you know, the jumping in back and forth between Jumbo and Tenryu, and then Hansen getting involved and kind of shorter title reigns back and forth, that, you know, Gordy getting a title reign, that to let someone have what ends up being an era defining title reign. And during this puts out a match that a lot of people think is one of the greatest, if not the greatest match of all time, not just from a match standpoint, but from a business standpoint. Like, the Budokan was as filled as it has ever been in an All Japan setting for that match. It really still stands the test of time after almost three decades. And I think that even though we really think about Misawa in a match by match, right? We can pinpoint the Kobashi matches, we can pinpoint the tags, we can pinpoint the Kawada matches. A lot of people forget the fact that this title reign really builds up the legend of Mitsuharu Misawa more than perhaps anything else. And we have the matches that we have to remember him by, I think, because of the fact that this title reign made him the unbeatable ace for almost 2 years. And there are ace-defining title reigns on here. Kenta Kobashi was one. This is one. Hogan's is another. And I think this is one of the better ace title reigns of its kind.
So let's hear from El Pariqua, who's going to talk about another ace-defining title reign of its time.
All right, let's go with John Cena. All right, specifically the 2006-2007 title reign, which is the one that begins when he defeats Edge for the WWE Championship at Unforgiven in a TLC match. This is basically – what's interesting is this is the point where we've been – it's 2006. It's been about a year since John Cena first won the championship at WrestleMania 21. And there had been some blowback and backlash starting on him
You know, the whole you can't wrestle mindset was permeating in the online community and on TV as well. I mean, Triple H taking his pot shots at him as well. So this reign is basically the one that kind of solidifies him as, you know, that guy. You know, Big Match John. I'd say this is the reign where you really see this coming to the fore. Because after this TLC match, he starts the Umaga feud, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Which is capped off by that amazing Last Man Standing match at the Royal Rumble that year. After that, his original WrestleMania opponent goes down to injury, which was Triple H, so that's a blessing in disguise. And Shawn Michaels is the opponent that steps up. And I know I know opinions on Shawn Michaels tend to be polarizing. But yeah, this was also a chance for Cena to show that he could definitely belong in the ring. And he had that series of matches with Michaels that also includes the four-way at Backlash that year. And here's the amazing thing. During that summer, Cena actually gets very watchable matches out of the Great Khali. Might be Khali's best match, actually.
Great matches.
I mean, this is if you think John Cena can wrestle, allow me to differ here. I mean, look what he does with Great Khali and Bobby Lashley, who's still, I mean, Bobby Lashley was still, you know, early on in his, he wasn't that great shakes at that point in time. And here you have John Cena, who supposedly can't wrestle. Look at the matches he was able to get out of them during his reign. These are the opponents that he's facing during that summer, right before he starts the Orton part of his feud. And then this is where we start getting, you know, the Orton feud was supposed to go on longer, but he ended up getting injured and has to vacate the title. So that's kind of like the little, like, in terms of the reign, which probably was going to go a little bit longer, or he might have lost Orton around that time. But this is the reign that I would say solidifies John Cena as Big Match John. It's a long reign by the standards as well as been talked about. I mean, around this time, it's three. According to what I'm looking at, it's 380 days. So over more than a year, and it was ended because of an injury, which, you know, led to that amazing 2008 Royal Rumble appearance and win as well. But that's, you know, post-mortem to the reign itself. I mean, it's tough because it's going up against one of the most amazing runs a wrestler has ever had in history in terms of match and in terms of just what, you know, we were talking about earlier in terms of credibility. Who is it the title or is it the wrestler that gives it? I mean, that is a clear case of everything being elevated at the same time. I mean, Misawa just elevated that triple crown into something. But Cena, this is the one that I would say you definitely can point to and say, no, Cena can wrestle and he can do it on the big stage against these opponents that are limited compared to some of the other ones that you say he can't do.
Yeah, so the Falls Count Anywhere match with Great Khali is fucking awesome. The Umaga match is an all-time classic. I thought his Shawn Michaels WrestleMania match was one of the best Shawn Michaels matches of his return. And some things I forgot. I'm looking up the reign here. He defended the title at Vengeance against Bobby Lashley, King Booker, Randy Orton,
right, the five-pack match. Yeah, the five-pack match.
What the fuck?
Very random.
He also went to OVW and defended against Sean Spears. I did not know that, actually.
Yeah, that's like your Daniel Bryan Danielson versus Kamala almost.
Kamala's better than Sean Spears. Come on.
Oh, absolutely. So on that same vein, really he was really slumming it there.
I can't insult Sean Spears. I used to drink at the same bars as him. So we'll go over there. But, I'm torn on this one. I love both these reigns. I wish Cena's had a proper end.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that kind of the one crimp in this reign. It's unfortunate that it was vacated because of injury, because it was such a great reign for that time period. and it's a very – I think it's a very underrated reign in the ski – in, you know, in terms of how it's – of how it's viewed, mostly because of – you know, in more recent times, John Cena appreciation has actually turned around and people actually appreciate what he was when he was in his heyday. But at the time, I mean, a lot of people weren't really seeing this. You know, they were seeing it, but they weren't really acknowledging that what they had in front of them.
Yeah, this was the reign that made me, like, turn completely in Cena's corner and, like, having to argue with people to be like, this guy's fucking one of the best in the world. How do you not see it through this reign? This one was, like, a real turnaround for me. But we'll throw to Matt here. I don't think he's weighed in.
I love that Cena title reign. Like, I love it so much. Like, the – I mean, that era, like, that's one of, like, the last, like, eras of WWE where I, like, oh, this is, like, a lot of really good stuff. Those Kali matches you mentioned, that Umaga match, obviously, we've talked about that on, like, half the podcast we've been on together, I feel like, that Umaga match. You know, some of the Shawn Michaels matches even. His character became a lot more a solid, too, I think. Yeah, I feel like after that reign, nobody could sanely argue that Cena wasn't a great wrestler. But it's another one of those things where it's just like, unfortunately, he's matched up against fucking Mitsuhara Misawa.
The reign, yeah, I know. The rest
of Kawada and all those great tag – like, come on. Like, I got to vote for Misawa. Like, I'm sorry. Like, Cena reign is more important to me personally, but that Misawa reign is just one of the greatest from one of the greatest. You know what I mean?
I'm right now on Cena's camp. So, I don't know what to do right now. I don't know. Tim, bring me over to your side.
June 3rd, 1994.
I'd take the fucking Umaga match over that, though.
Nah, like...
Watch them again. I love that Umaga match, but
look, man, I understand why that Umaga match. Like, I think there's, that Umaga match is probably it's the most unique match of its kind because there has never been a Last Man Standing match better than that. But I mean, come on, like I just can't. Like I wrote 3,000 words on that freaking match a couple months back. Like I can't. Like I'm sorry, here's the other thing, right? One of the things that we haven't really talked about, like, there are era-defining title matches. There are title-reigning title matches, right? Like, the title defining title match of that reign, I don't think there's going to be a single match on any of these reigns that is going to touch that match. That is the biggest thing it has going for it, is that match.
But it just also – it also has that Misawa is such a legendary Triple Crown champion, and this is his, like, first big reign. You know, like, that also is a major part of it.
Because convince Matt to switch.
Hi. Sorry, I was on mute. The problem is, I don't think I'm going to be able to convince them because it's such a, you know, when they say genre defining, so it's that ring is so it's just so defining.
Bariqua, can we convince you? Bariqua is the question.
Yeah, no, I'll be honest. As much as I love that,
I want to see Misawa versus Samoa Joe.
Yeah, no, let's do it. Let's put this up. Let's do it.
Just because of what the next matchup is, I want to see it.
Jeez. So now, man, oh, God. Well, I was afraid this might happen, so.
Have to argue amongst your children.
Looking ahead, yeah, that makes my pick. Yeah. I still prefer the Cena reign, but I want to see
Yeah, no, and I'll say I'll give the edge to Misawa simply because it is like you know it's the only way I can say it's genre defining basically. I mean it is that.
All right, Rick, well, why don't you? We got Lex Luger's U.S. title reign from 1990 versus Randy Savage's 88 to 89 WWF World title reign. So I'll let you argue for some Lex Luger there, Rick.
Lex Luger, the man who gets very unfairly dumped on by a lot of people. Particularly, you know, this is peak Lex Luger right here. 1989, let's set the scene. It's the U.S. title. Why is Luger the U.S. champion? Because he had come up short against Ric Flair for the NWA World title. Flair said that Luger would no longer have any matches and challenges against him. So Luger decides to go for the U.S. title, which automatically makes him the number one contender in the hopes that that will put him in line for the NWA World title. Now, here's the thing where I was mentioning earlier about the blips. Because he defeats Barry Windham to win the U.S. title at WrestleWar 89, if I'm not mistaken. No, wait, sorry, Chi-Town Rumble, 89. And then, for some reason at WrestleWar, he proceeds to lose it to Michael Hayes for 2 weeks. Why? I don't know. 2 weeks. 2 weeks. So, technically, the rate I'm looking at would begin 2 weeks later after WrestleWar 89 when he wins it back from Michael Hayes. Now, what follows is a great combination of character arc and matches as well. And this is Lex Luger, a guy that gets dumped on by a lot of people, undeservedly, at least during this time. What happens? He wins the United States title, and basically, because of his frustration in not being able to get the world title match that he desperately wants, when they name Ricky Steamboat once again and potentially in line for the number one contendership, it's amazing at the Clash when he comes out and basically just airs out his entire frustration about the fact that he's the U.S. champion, he should be the number one contender, and just lays out Ricky Steamboat, causing him to lose against Terry Funk. And that sets off his feud with Ricky Steamboat, which is short-lived because Steamboat ends up leaving, but ends up with that great match at Great American Bash 89, where if Steamboat gets DQ'd, they changed the stipulation at the beginning. But it's a fantastic match where you can see that Luger definitely can hold his own in the ring. And from there, he has this great series of matches against a variety of opponents. Tommy Rich. Brian Pillman's first major exposure in the NWA comes against matches with Lex Luger. Year's end, you have the tournament, against Muda, Flair, and Sting, where he holds his own. Doesn't win, but, you know, he's established as well as a contender. And then, here's the amazing wrinkle of all this, character-wise. Sting goes down due to injury. Luger remains the U.S. champion, and another fortuitous turn here because it was supposed to be Steve Williams winning it, but because plans changed, they dropped all that, and Williams went to Japan. And here's the interesting thing. In a way, it was, you know, like a sudden – they had to do this because they had no choice because Sting went down. But it fits so great character-wise because why did Luger become U.S. champion? Because he wanted a shot in the NWA World Championship. Why did he turn heel? Because it wasn't coming to him, and it was frustration. Now he finally gets what he so long wanted, the NWA World title shot. And when he's asked to turn it down, hell no, he's not going to turn it down. Do you know how long he's been waiting for this? So he turns face, and we get, like, the last – at WrestleWar 90, we get this fantastic match between Flair and Luger. And then, obviously, we have Capital Combat, which we have the whole cage match. It gets a little wonky here because they didn't want to drop the title yet to Luger. And then that summer, he spends it basically murking these big dudes. I mean, Mark Callis, Sid Vicious. He just dominates the U.S. Over these challengers until Stan Hansen shows up. And again, it's a little blip. It's longer. It's 2 months. But this is where the reign ends against Stan Hansen, which sets up the eventual where he regains it at Starrcade 90. And then he goes on to that final run as U.S. champion where he ends up winning the NWA World title. But this particular reign, you get some really good to great matches against a variety of opponents. But you also get this terrific character arc for Lex Luger within it as well.
I love this reign. I'm going to let everybody talk about it, but I know Randy Savage's reign is great too. So this is we've had some really tough first round matchups. We really have.
I wish those Luger reigns could all be counted as one.
Right.
I mean, 15 days. I mean, oh man, why, Michael Hayes? Why?
Yeah.
All right. I love Lex Luger. That's a great reign. But let's be real. Randy Savage. This title reign is really one big year long storyline. Randy Savage. He wins the tournament at WrestleMania 4. Four matches in one night. To win a tournament. And basically that's the start of the Mega Powers. Him and Hogan are friends. Hogan's the former champion. And now Savage is the champion. And then he beats Ted DiBiase in the tournament final. And they go on to have a great feud. A lot of great matches. And the Mega Powers, they're forming their team. You have the Mega Powers Mega Bucks at SummerSlam, which is pretty awesome. All the while we're having the house show matches between Savage and DiBiase, which is great. But they start to set the seeds for Hogan and Savage that maybe Savage is in Hogan's shadow. And although they're both baby faces, you know, Savage is a little of a wild man. He has some great matches against Andre the Giant, which I love. He has that great feud with Bad News Brown, which a great street fight they have in Hamilton in 89. But they have a great feud there. But we have the very slow turn throughout the whole year of Savage just starting to be a little jealous of Hogan, and Hogan maybe making some moves on his woman. We move on to the Mega Powers taking on the Twin Towers in a great little feud there. That sets the whole thing off where Savage turns on Hogan, turns heel. This is a world title reign that spans a year that includes a heel turn, which is pretty fucking awesome. And Savage is one of the all-time great babyfaces and one of the all-time great heels. So he turns heel here. But they kind of do this thing where it's kind of like, yeah, Savage is the heel, but maybe he has some good points in it. Like, Elizabeth doesn't really pick a side. And he moves on to WrestleMania, where he faces Hogan in the exact same building where kind of the Mega Powers are formed. Same building, same show the next year, where Hogan ends up defeating him, which turns Savage into royalty soon after. But, like, what a fucking story arc for a title reign from the new crowning babyface with his friend to eventually just getting jealous of his friend and turning on him, and then his friend defeating him in the same fucking arena on the same show the next year. It's very beautiful, this whole title reign, and a lot of good stuff in between the beginning and the end. But you have the overarching story, which it's kind of really impressive for a title reign. It's very rare to have a title reign that's built around a whole storyline. Like, you have CM Punk's in, like, the summer of 05, but that's only a summer. This is a whole fucking year. So I love this title reign. So I'm going to defend this one. I'm not giving up on this one. Tim.
So the one reason I think I'm going to go with Savage here is because of the Michael Hayes thing. It's like, I don't know why they did it. I don't know why they thought it was worth it. I was like, because having him have that title for a year and then have what happened at Super Brawl with Flair happen, it's like, man, like, how cool would that have been? But like, the Savage reign is also like, it is his defining era, you know? It's the thing that really defines what Savage is in WWF lore. And it's hard for me to not go with that. It really is. So I have to. It's just like, I love that Luger reign. I love the matches in that Luger reign. I talked about the Brian Pillman match as one of my favorite matches in the WCW pod we did, but I got to go with Savage here. It would be wrong for me not to.
Matthew?
This is actually probably the hardest one for me. they're both similarly great for kind of different reasons. I do think that Luger's has the better matches. I mean, it makes sense. It was the NWA versus WWF. But man, that Savage Reign, it was so important to me and every young Northeastern kid at the time. Just character defining, era defining. You know, as much as WrestleMania 5 and 4 were bad WrestleManias, we still remember them fondly just because of, like, the aura of these characters and this angle. Yeah, it's tough. It's so tough. Like, I could easily be swayed, but I'm going to go with Savage.
Brickla?
Stupid sexy haze.
Yeah, right?
Purely sexy, right?
Oh, God. That was a great match, though. The one that you lost the title was a great match. But
it was. Oh yeah, that's
also that those two title reigns. That was a great matchup.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still sticking with Luger, but I'm outvoted, so Savage moves on.
All right, I was bound I get to win eventually. But let's move on. The final match of the first round, the longest the round where we kind of get our initial arguments out. So usually, if you didn't listen to the last one, it goes much quicker from here.
It's only been 2.5 hours.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Thank goodness daylight savings time changed, because if not, I'd be at midnight right about now.
Right. Yeah, that's true. All right. Matt is going to argue for Ric Flair. Is Terry Funk to I don't know who this is a 2 and 90.
Sting.
Sting. Oh yeah.
Great Steamboat to Matt. Sting.
Okay, and then Aja Kong for Tim. Let's see, this is the last time anyone argued. So that was Tim last time. So we'll go with Matt here. Why don't you go first?
Okay, so like I told you, this was tough for me because I wanted to pick a Flair reign, and he had so many because he would lose them for little bits at a time. But basically, he was the NWA champion for – he was the champion of the 80s, right? Like, you know, there were other champions at the beginning of the decade that had good reigns, but from, like, Starrcade on, the first Starrcade on, Ric Flair was the perennial champion. You know, Rhodes would have it, Garvin had it, Steamboat had it. And at the end of the series with Steamboat, Flair wins it back in one of the great matches of all time, and he proceeds to turn babyface in that moment, gets pile-driven on a table by Terry Funk in one of the great angles of all time. So already, the very beginning of this reign, two of the greatest things of all time have happened. And on the first, like, 40 minutes of this reign. And so Ric Flair has this great babyface run, comes back beloved from this neck injury to challenge Terry Funk. They have an incredible match at Great American Bash. Just a great feud throughout that summer, including a some liked, some disliked Thunderdome cage match involving the great Muda and Sting, this incredible brawl at the end of Great American Bash. Then they have the I Quit match at the Clash of Champions, which, again, one of the greatest matches of all time. You know, from there, Ric Flair eventually, not too long after that, turns heel. The Four Horsemen turn on Sting, leading to what should have been like this big epic match at WrestleWar, but of course Sting gets hurt. And so it turns into a match against Lex Luger, who is hastily turned babyface. But on the bright side, they have an incredible match again, where Flair just have such great chemistry. Flair beats him in another classic. Now Flair is once again a great heel. He reforms the Four Horsemen with Barry Windham returning. Sid Vicious joins the Horsemen. Ole is back. Arn is back. You know, classic Ric Flair heel run. And then finally, he loses it to Sting in maybe a slightly disappointing match, but it was a great moment. You know, it was a really good show. Just this was, you know, everyone talks about 1989 NWA. This was Flair's year. You know, even though a couple of the best matches happened before this reign begins, it's still all part of the same package. This is Flair at his peak, I would say. I don't think he ever reaches quite these heights ever again. And it's just loaded with amazing stuff. It's just a defining reign of an era, and a great era, I think, for NWA wrestling. If you like Ric Flair at all, I think this reign encapsulates everything that's great about him.
Yeah, this one's great. But before we get to Tim, we've been talking so long, some huge news broke. I don't know if you saw this, Tim. The fucking NBA season's been suspended.
Yeah, no, I've been watching it on mute in the background. It's been crazy, man.
Oh,
yeah,
my fucking God.
Like, and Tom Hanks. It's
been suspended.
Wow.
This Tom Hanks as well has been
diagnosed. Yeah, Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson both contracted it. So, yeah, things are going to get interesting, folks.
Oh, yeah.
Just to start. So.
All right.
So.
Let's get back to fun. Kong, please.
Boy, wow. Where do I start with this? So.
Start with one of the greatest matches ever.
Yeah, I mean, look. Like,
hey, I did that, so you could do it too.
True. But I was going to say, so one of the things that's interesting about all these title matches that we talked about is, yeah, it's like the matches where the title change happens to start. Yeah, these are two of the better title reigns that start with an amazing match, right? You have the Steamboat Flair match, and then you have the Nakano Aja Kong match, where Kong, in her third attempt to win the title, finally beats Kong or Nakano and starts her 2.5-year-long reign. Look, like, it's amazing how much Kong, I think, this is a title reign that it's kind of a weird one, but the reason why I wanted to pick it was essentially that when describing what someone meant to the company, it wasn't just the fact that Aja Kong was the 3WA champ. It was that once she beat Bull Nakano for the title, she was like unquestionably the ace of the promotion. Now, Nakano was still around, Hokuto was still around, and then you had all the interpromotional stuff with LLPW and JWP and FMW and all these other promotions, JD, that were trying to be integrated into All Japan standing as the top of the mountain. And even amongst all that, Aja was still presented as kind of the unbeatable force, right? Like, as much as Hokuto, her knee injury that eventually caused her to, in her words, retire, right? And then she came back years later with Gaia. Like, Kong was still 100% seen as the top of the women's wrestling world at the time, even more than Bull, who – for so long since Dump Matsumoto's retirement was seen as that person. But, I've talked about the kind of the ace title reign. This is very much an ace title reign. There's not a lot of title defenses, but what Aja does as champion, it's not necessarily just the title matches, but with what she does as champion in her tag team with Kyoko Inoue, in the tag matches, of course, the Queendom tag in March of 1994, the V-Top tournament at the Dome on the Big Egg Universe show where she has the Minami Toyota match that basically makes Toyota a single star. And then, of course, that leading to her beating Aja for the title 4 months later. This is perhaps the most the title reign that I think has the most flexibility. It's not necessarily all about her defending the title, which I think a lot of these title reigns are defined by. This is her as champion, as the unbeatable force, as the person at the top of the entire women's wrestling world in Japan, regardless of who the top stars are in this interpromotional stuff that leads the Big Egg Universe. She is still on top. She holds that belt. She held the belt for 2.5 years. And what she does as champion is unquestionably one of the most important things that's done during that high watermark for women's wrestling business in Japan. And from a business standpoint, from a match quality standpoint, the Hata matches, the Kansai matches, the Queendom tag, the 1993 Tag League the Best tournament – all these things that she was a part of, either as champion in a title match or as the ace of the promotion, like, there are very few people that presented themselves as the true definitive ace with the championship belt better than her. And it's not for me so much about the title matches. It is about what she does with the title. And that's what I love about this. I don't know what other title reign on here does the most with that person having the title around her to influence the other parts of the promotion more than her standing with the belt. So I'm a big fan of this reign. It's not as like I said, it's not as heavy as some of the other ones, but man, what it encompasses for that time frame, for that time in the promotion, and for women's wrestling in general, huge fan. Huge, huge fan.
Yeah, and you have – she was the fucking champion during the Dream Slams, which are like the most iconic shows in wrestling history, in my opinion. And yeah, this wasn't about the title matches per se. It was about her being the top star when All Japan Women – feuded with every other promotion in Japan. Like, she was in tag matches, trios matches, you know, the Thunder, I don't even know what you call that 10 woman one where the weird rules, that is one of the greatest matches of all time. She's in that, but she's defending the honor of All Japan Women without defending the title so much in a variety of different ways as their ace, which is great. Plus, you know, the Bullet Kano matches, the Dynamite Kansei matches, Mikama Kudo, Hodo, the Minato Toyota, just so many legendary stuff. Yeah, I'm a big fan of this. What do you think, Barika? Where are you sitting?
Well, here's the interesting thing that you mentioned with the Aja Khan reign, that, you know, it's not so much the title defense, it's about that. She's representing. She's this ensemble for us, and she's representing, you know, her company. The Ric Flair. I nervous to be in the discussion with Flair's reign, or at least this particular one, is how. I mean, when you really think about it, let's see. He gets attacked. He wins the title at the capping off the Steamboat Trilogy. He then gets put on the shelf by Terry Funk because he refuses to give Terry Funk a title shot, is out for like a month and a half, you know, selling the injury, comes back at the Great American Bash in defending against Terry Funk, and then for the rest of that year, clashes and pay-per-views, not one single title defense. It's all tag matches or it's all non-title matches for the rest of the year that he's champion. So outside of the initial setup for the feud, you could say that him being champion is almost inconsequential to what he did from that point forward after Great American Bash 89. Then, of course, you get to 90, you get the great Luger matches. You get that Junkyard Dog match, which is the less said about that, the better. And then Sting ends up taking the title. So it's interesting when you mentioned that Aja Khan didn't have, you know, maybe not as many title fans, because the Ric Flair reign that we're looking at is not one that you could say is actually notable for him actually having title offenses in the high profile slots that they had during that time.
I mean, the two arguments, obviously the Great American Bash Funk match and then the Super Brawl match, right? Those two matches are very – or the Wrestle War match, I should say. Those two matches are incredible.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
And so
– and the first Luger match in 90 is also really fucking great, I think.
Yeah, the lead up to that. Right. Yeah. I don't know. Oh, I think that at some point you know, the Flair, that title reign, that was – I also think that when Sting got hurt, that instead of Luger, he should have faced Muda, and Muda should have beat him for the belt in 90.
Jim Ross,
I still stand by that.
Jim Ross says he thinks that
too. I absolutely agree with that. Muda should have been the Muscle War opponent.
And that happening meant Muda left the company. Muda left right after that happened. He did Clash 10 or Clash 10. They had the cage match. Muda was over like a motherfucker in that match. It was like, holy shit. Like, oh man, Sting gets hurt that night climbing the cage. Like, Muda's right there. and they decide not to do anything with them. And that sucks. Like, that's one of those things where it's like, man, it's like, could you imagine if it ended with Flair giving Muta the business instead of them going back to Luger? But yeah, I just – that's a personal thing. And like I said, it's funny that Jim Ross thinks that, because the political strife in 1990 in WCW, that's a real thing, folks. That is – my goodness. There were some things that happened at the beginning of 1990 that led to, you know, the Kip Fry shit and all that stuff. So it's something else.
Are we split?
So – I'm gonna, you know what? I think Barriqua convinced me.
Oh, fuck.
That.
Man.
Kong is the way to go here.
All right.
I love that Ric Flair reign, but because he didn't have so many title defenses and because it's one of many great reigns, whereas this is a defining reign for Aja Kong and for that era, I'm gonna give it to her.
Second round matchup. Are insane. Oh my god.
And again, it's not that, you know, the problem I think with Ric Flair is that it's so tough to to pinpoint a reign, because he always had it broken up at certain points, so you can't really technically you can't roll into everything together because of that.
From Starrcade 83 until he left WCW in 91, it's probably the greatest reign of all time. But
if you
can't do that.
If you do it, no. If you even do Starrcade 87 to all the way to when he lost to the Sting, if he doesn't lose it to Steamboat, or even then, I mean, there was no reason for him to lose it to Garvin either. I mean,
yeah.
When you look at it that way, that would have been one legendary reign.
That's true also. Yeah, you get the Sting match in there from 88, right? You get the War Games stuff. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, almost 3 hours in, we have made it to round two.
Oh, my goodness.
I do feel like we're going to have a little bit easier time now.
Yeah.
Because I think we've laid out all the arguments so much. I think we know where we stand on all of these, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more like voting time now.
Yeah.
So, first up, we have Hulk Hogan's first WWF title reign from 84 to 88. And we have Bryan Danielson's Ring of Honor reign from 05 to 06, his first as well.
Pretty similar title reigns. They were pretty similar.
Yeah. Right?
This is a contrast right here, I shall say.
Hogan wore a cape as Thunderlips, so don't forget that.
Oh, yeah. I love Rocky. Tim, where are you sitting?
I think I'm going to go Danielson.
Okay.
I love Danielson. I'd have to lean towards Hogan. But could be swayed.
I'm with Barriqua. I love the Danielson reign, but I have to stick with Hogan here. This reign's too important. Matt.
It's really tough. You're right about the Hogan reign, but man, that Danielson reign, it's so important to me personally. I can't just give it up. Someone's got to convince me. I think I can be convinced, but it's a much shorter period of time. But Danielson has so many great matches, way more than Hogan does. Like, Hogan has lots of good matches and is interesting, but Danielson has incredible matches, becomes this incredible wrestler. I guess it depends on what you're looking for in a title reign. You can't have a much more important reign than Hogan's first reign. I will give you that. But in the ring, as a character, and just the fact that this guy's my favorite, and this was his defining moment, I got to go with Danielson, at least for a few minutes.
All right. So Hulk Hogan comes into the company. From the AWA, he's emerging as this great star. WWF is a fucking regional promotion. Hulk Hogan comes in, gets the title, basically does what Bruno did, where he kind of has a challenger. They do it around the loop a few times. They have a few no contests and going back, and then they go back for a blow-off. So he has the fucking great matches with Kamala, with Don Morocco versus the Piper stuff. You could go on and on. But he starts off as a regional champion, and they start just going from territory to territory, that within a year, it's WrestleMania 1. And he's the biggest star in the world. He's hosting Saturday Night Live. 2 years later, they're drawing 90,000 people in the biggest show of all time against Andre. A year later, they're drawing the biggest TV rating of all time versus Andre on the main event. They were a regional promotion at the start of that reign. At the end, they're the biggest wrestling company that's ever lived and probably ever will be, drawing some of the biggest things that ever drawn.
Yeah, I kind of just I had to do the exercise. Yeah. I couldn't just give up right away. This is like the most important title reign of the past 50 years. It has to win.
Yeah, it's like it's difficult.
I love Brian, but yeah.
And that's the thing. I know Matt was there for all this, right? Yeah. Matt was there for
It's so Brian, personal to me.
Like Brian becoming kind of the final form, right? And man, it's like people forget how like that Joe match, when that Joe match happened, oh shit, man. People it because it was so time frame, it was right after the Kobashi match, right?
Yeah.
Which is just like, oh shit. So Joe's gonna go from facing Kobashi to facing Danielson. How the hell are they gonna make this work, you know? By the way, the Liger match happened in there too, right?
Well, no, the Liger match was a couple years earlier. It was before Danielson was champion.
Holy shit, that was way earlier than I thought. I for some reason had that 05.
It was November 04.
Yeah. A lot of people going crazy over the Kenta Key match, and I think I still prefer the Mara Fuji Danielson match from that show. So I don't know. But yeah, okay. We'll go with Hogan. I hate seeing this reign go just because I think I'm glad we got to talk about it, but I just think it's been kind of forgotten and it's kind of sadly forgotten. Yeah.
It was an unfortunate matchup for him, but Hogan is Hogan, and that first reign is that first reign.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard. It's all going to be hard from here.
Yeah, it's about how we balance all the different factors that can go into the reign.
Right.
Okay, so now we have our good friend Carlos Colon, his Universal title reign versus Kenta Kobashi's GHC Noah reign. Where are we sitting?
I gotta go with Kobashi. Like this reign was a big deal. I've seen it a lot more than I saw the Cologne reign. The Cologne reign sounds like a blast, but that Kobashi reign was a blast in its own right, and it was very important. And Kobashi is the fucking man.
I'm sorry, Bariqua. I love you. I love you. I love Cologne, but I gotta go with Kobashi.
I'll say this, there are a lot of people who think that bull rope match is better than maybe any of the matches that are part of the Kobashi reign.
There's a lot
of people who say that. Like,
there's a certain type of fan that would say that. I feel like I'm not quite at that level yet, but I would respect it definitely. Like, it's different tastes.
Watch the whole.
I'm just happy the fact that, you know what, this is creating awareness.
Someone put a one, like a 2.5 hour video on YouTube of the whole
thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So watch that. Watch it. Everyone. No, you can't listen to our next podcast until you've watched that video.
I will watch it.
Okay. This goes for the listeners too. You're barred from listening to the next podcast until you watch that YouTube video. All right, we're moving on. That's good. So, oh god, that's going to be a battle. All right, before that, we got Samoa Joe's Ring of Honor reign versus Misawa's 92-94 Triple Crown reign.
I'm gonna make this easy. I'm picking Samoa Joe's reign. I love the Misawa reign. It does have the greatest match, perhaps of all time, as part of it. I'm sorry. That Samoa Joe reign is one of the most impressive feats in the history of American professional wrestling.
And important. And very important.
And I don't think – I think that the great majority of professional wrestling that exists today in the United States would not happen without that Samoa Joe reign. And I fervently believe that.
I think there's a good case to be made for that. And those Punk matches and that character and like that promotion in general just existing on the level it did, I think you're right.
Yeah.
I'm voting for that too, by the way.
All right. So finally, like this round has gone good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Randy Savage's first WWF title reign. Versus Aja Kong's first WWWA title reign. Oh, boy.
I think it's the weakest matchup of this second round compared to a lot of the other ones that went earlier, but got to think on this moment.
I 100% know. So here's the thing. Do either of these have a shot at Samoa Joe?
No.
Right. So I'm okay giving it up that at least I got to talk about Aja Kong being the baddest woman on the planet for 2.5 years.
I fucking love Kong. But I also really love Savage.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most well done angles in the history of professional wrestling done during the Savage reign.
It's almost impossible for me to like really fairly pick, but I think I'm going to go with my childhood heart. With Randy Savage here. Right. Like you said, we know it's going to lose in the next round. So, like, it is what it is.
I think the first wrestling tape I ever rented was WrestleMania. Like, the first one I anticipated.
That double box. Yeah.
WrestleMania 5. All right, here's my WrestleMania 5 story. Because this we didn't have pay-per-view at the time. Because we didn't get it until, like, 98.
Yeah, closed circuit, right?
No, not in Canada. We didn't get shit, man. But we had to wait for the tape to come out, and it came out very quickly after. And I remember just being like, "Oh, wait and wait." This is a tape where I got my mom to rent it on her way home from work the day it was released. But she came home with the beta tape, and I had to make her. And I hate like saying, you know, I'm sorry, mom, but like this is wrong. But we didn't have Betamax; we only had VHS. So I had to like get my mom. Worked, you know, her 8-hour shift at the bank to stop at a video store on the way home, rent the wrong copy, and then go back to the video store. I made her go back that day to get me the VHS copy so I could watch Hogan Savage.
Your mom really loves you.
She's a great person. She's really awesome. But yeah, this was my jam here. So, but Samoa Joe goes to the finals. So we'll just deal with that
quickly. I'm about to say, it's like, we might
as well
talk about that round, right? It's like, I'm sorry, Samoa Joe moves on.
Yeah.
Let's just get that through.
Yeah. So,
now, this one.
Yeah, this one.
Let's have this discussion.
Oh, boy.
How right? do you have this discussion? Because, like, it's not like an apples
it's
to apples
It's polar
thing.
Opposites. It's almost polar opposites.
So I have to go to bat for Kobashi here because I'm the one who put this here, and I know that Matt will most likely do the same thing. But I think it is the most recognizable Japanese title reign in history. I don't think there is a title reign, and a lot of people have recency bias with Okada's reign that we had on this. But let's face facts. The reason why Okada's defense number went above the mark, it wasn't just because of the Kobashi or the Tanahashi title reign. It was the Kobashi title reign too. The fact that it went that long, there's a reason it did. There's a reason why the 2-year reign of Kento Kobashi was held in such high regard. New Japan had tried to do this 2 more times after this. 2 more times. And they did well to varying degrees. But it's like this is the better version of the Misawa title reign. This is the better version of the Aja title reign. This is a title reign that has a direct influence on business. Just like Hogan, they're able to run the fucking Tokyo Dome, the biggest thing Japan can do with him on top. They do that.
Sorry, Kito, I got a question. The Did they get 90,000 people in the Dokkan?
They can't get 90,000 people in the
Dokkan. Okay. It did that night.
Yeah. About to say, appreciate it. No, they got 55, I want to say, was the number they got. Somewhere close to that range. But like, I just keep going back to the fact that, like, there were people wondering if Noah was still going to be like Noah because of what was happening in New Japan, and All Japan was kind of, yeah, they had Muto, but it was kind of floundering. Like, there were a lot of questions about Japanese professional wrestling in 2003, and fucking Kobashi brought, like, Tenryu came in, Takayama came in, Suzuki came in, 0-1, they came in. There was definitely a time where perhaps a Hashimoto match was on the table before 0-1 and All Japan decided to get cozy. I mean, the influence, it's a much smaller in number, yeah, but man, like, the importance of that title reign is substantial. Absolutely substantial.
And I just got to say, Hogan had two title matches that drew more than that. You know, he also had the big event in Toronto against Paul Orndorff, which was one of the greatest feuds of all time as well, for money-wise. We didn't even touch on the Orndorff feud that was so hot in 86 after Orndorff turned on Hogan and started using his music. His friend turned on him there. We're talking about this Hogan reign like it was just all posing and drawing fans. No, there's fucking great matches in here. The Kamala matches are unreal, especially early on when he was changing it up. The bloodbath with Schultz. I love the Morocco matches.
The early Savage matches
from like 86. Terry Funk matches. Harley Race matches. Name it. The Andre match, I really like it too, and he had some other good Andre matches. Name a great fucking wrestler at the time. The Bundy matches were fun too, but you can just name any star from the 80s, and they had a huge match against Hogan during this reign, essentially. And just the importance, like I said, we're forgetting they were essentially a regional promotion when he started. And by the time he ended, they were drawing like ungodly numbers that no one's ever drawn since.
You lost the title with the biggest television audience that watched wrestling in years.
Even just getting on NBC was a huge deal.
Right. And that all happened on MTV.
Look, I had to stump for Kobashi. I just had to, guys. Like, it's like, you know, the one thing I'll say about both of these reigns, though, is they both kind of ended in ways that were suspect.
Yeah.
But paying off a referee to get plastic surgery
is suspect.
I would agree with that, but I would also say WWF recovered from theirs a bit better
than they did.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Let's do another round of voting, I think. Matt, where are you sitting?
I mean, I love that Kobashi reign. It would certainly provide a much more parallel and more challenging final round, but you know, like I said about the Hogan reign, the most important U.S. title reign in 40 or 50 years, the most successful drawing reign, and like you said, it had its matches. Was not a slouch in the wrestling department. So that Kobashi reign, it would be my number two pick for this whole thing easily. But I'm going with Hogan here.
Tim.
I'm going Kobashi.
Nice. Barikla?
I have to lean towards Hogan in this case, but man, the thing is that it's Kobashi is like the mirror image of the Joe in some senses.
Yeah, that's the issue. Because like, if this was the finals, right? I'd vote for Hogan on this. As much as I don't like Hulk Hogan as a person.
Yeah, look at us defending a racist here.
I know.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, let's not talk about personal stuff. Let's try. I know I'm not the one to usually do that, but let's leave the personal stuff away. If this was the finals, I would vote the Hogan match. But this is the semis, right? And what is a more fascinating finals? The Joe versus Kobashi or Joe versus Hogan? Fuck, I wish I saw a Hulk Hogan versus Joe match. Now that I'm thinking about it, that would be awesome.
I'm sure there was a TNA match that wasn't that great.
Oh, and Hulk Hogan is such an asshole, and Kobashi seems like such a nice guy.
Kobashi, late life Kobashi social media has been tremendous. He's the great, him and Kojima are the great, and then Grandpa Tenryu. I can't get enough of it. It's so good. But I think it's pretty obvious Hogan's the guy, sadly. But boy, so now
Kobashi takes better pictures with other people than Triple H does with everybody he poses with in NXT.
Yes.
All right.
But can I ask a quick question before we go straight up to the finals? Since we didn't really discuss Samoa Joe, I have a curious question. Which one between the Bryan Danielson reign and the Samoa Joe reign would you lean more towards of those two?
I think I have to go with the Joe reign as much. And the reason I've go with the I've talked about the Danielson reign and tried to prop it up so much is because I just don't think it gets talked about enough.
Yeah.
But it's like, I think, just, and Matt, I can't wait to hear Matt's argument here because he talked about how important the Hogan reign is. But I think the argument is that the analog for the Hulk Hogan reign is a wild statement to think about, but with 15 years of hindsight, it's looking pretty damn accurate, which is just, if you want to talk about importance, that is substantial. Like, you can't ignore that. So I love Danielson. Obviously, I think he's the greatest wrestler living right now, but man, that Joe reign is, it's undeniable. No,
that's my read as well, that the Joe reign was probably the more important one of the two, I'd say. But
it's definitely the more important one. Yeah, I'd say it's inarguable.
Okay, just wanted to see if we could just some extra discussion since we really just breezed Joe on into the finals.
It's tough. I mean, obviously I picked Joe. He's a great reign. That Hogan reign, I mean, he made such a great case. It went on for so long, and there were just so many big feuds, big matches, so many big moments. I feel like I said everything I can about the Samoa Joe reign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was phenomenal. His performances were phenomenal that whole time. He didn't have the machine behind him that Hogan had, right? Hogan had the WWF machine just humming at, you know, it was Vince's peak as far as like being a logical, smart booker that was able to get things the way he wanted them, right?
And the machines led to
Yes. Samoa Joe never tagged with the machines. He never got to be a machine, in fact.
He never got the Hulk. He never got to wrestle Junji Harada. It was terrible.
So
let's put it out there. The Joe won quality match wise. Easily wins.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like Kobashi.
Yeah.
Right.
And the Hogan one wins for importance. And like
importance and storylines and, you know, drawing and probably promos. Not that Joe's promos were bad. Like, he definitely had a style that was really cool, like I thought. But Hogan probably wins with that and his opponents and, like, the storytelling in general. I think Hogan wins on everything except for the matches, honestly, and the human being. But
I'll say this. I don't think there was literally anything else you could have gotten out of Samoa Joe's reign more than what you did. I think his reign was maximized to the fullest potential for what ROH was at the time.
I will argue one thing they could have gotten out of it that they didn't.
Okay, go ahead.
The one-on-one low-key match.
Yeah. Yes.
That was something everyone was dying to see, and they never delivered it.
So, and that's because low-key gone low-key. But, you know, I mean, that's the thing, right? So there's a couple of quote-unquote missed opportunities. perhaps, but it's like, phew, for all the things he could control, like, I don't know what else you could have asked for Samoa Joe in that title reign. It's just and like I said, like, think about the people involved with that and the spiral from that over the next 10 to 15 years that came out of this, no matter what you think of them now. But like, he basically made CM Punk. He made Austin Aries. He turned Homicide from a guy that I think had a lot of stuff behind him into somebody nuanced to the point that in 2 years he would become the top guy in the promotion. The people he made along the way and the people he helped elevate to the point that there was not just Joe and a bunch of people that you know fly in or drive in to fight him, that speaks to something. The one thing I'll say about Hogan, though, is who is really going to be the guy to defeat him, right? Like, you know, Race, Funk, Orndorff, Bundy, like, that was kind of the thing. It's like, I think the one thing that I don't like about the reign is that looking back on it, if you logically went through it, it kind of seemed like he steamrolled fools. And I know that people kind of bought into Bundy and bought into, you know, some of the bigger guys, but
they
I think
could have gave Piper a reign.
Right. That's the thing. Like, the Piper stuff just kind of ending like it did was very weird.
Yeah.
Very weird. And, you know, and I'm like I said, I'm trying to poke holes in an argument that is like so far ahead for Hogan that it's kind of like difficult, but it's interesting to kind of bring up these things or along the way that, you know, that machine kind of allowed Hogan to do the unscathed thing for 2.5 years. And then when Andre was failing, Vince was like, we got to do something with him. And it just became at that point a situation that, especially now that you look back on it, you're like, well, I think there's probably a few things that they could have done a little bit better. And like you said, if the only thing that really could be said about the Joe reign was that they couldn't get low key enough to figure out if he actually wanted to come in and job to Joe, which is what he didn't want to do. Like, if they figured that out, holy shit, man. Throw Joe and low key in the middle of that reign. Holy shit.
Do
that
so like Hogan could have
anniversary show, yeah.
He could have had a Jake Roberts feud. It could have had a better ending.
Yeah.
There was a variety of the other opponents, you know, they could have done a little bit more with that. Some of them they just kept it on the house show loop, some they put on pay per view. So there's definitely more they could have done. It's interesting to look at these two reigns side by side.
Yeah. What I've gotten is from this conversation is that Loki apparently was Roddy Piper, was Samoa Joe's Roddy Piper, basically.
Well, the biggest thing, please. And Matt, you can kind of back it up, is that Loki didn't really need ROH to like get over, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's absolutely true.
Everything that Loki did was almost outside the company, right? He had TNA, he had Zero One, New Japan.
Yeah, like, he had a lot more.
Sort of true. I mean, definitely true. But
right.
As long as he hadn't burnt the bridge yet.
But ROH gave him a platform that none of the other places gave him. His most legendary stuff was in ROH, and he never – once he left ROH for good, his profile never got back to where it was, even when he was in WWE and they, you know, he was kind of a jobber there obviously. But they – you know, he never got back to the level of respect and regard that he was given in that 2002 to 2006 period where he was in ROH for a lot of that time and having those matches. If people look back at the greatest low-key matches of all time, still most people are going to mention ROH matches near the top.
Right. I think him getting trained by Lay Cool was absolutely amazing.
Made for good TV.
Do you remember his rap where he ended by saying something about total nonstop?
Yeah.
No, I don't. That's hilarious.
Cringe. Well, I think we know who the winner is here. It's sad to think. I mean, I don't think it's sad. It's just like we kind of figured this would be the case, right? Like, it's just like, well, how do you turn around and not vote for perhaps the most important title reign, the most defining title reign in the history of pro wrestling.
I think I'm just an idiot. I didn't think of this reign when I was originally thinking.
Although I've thought about it, but I also felt like, do I really want to vote for it?
I wouldn't have picked it, but it's good that somebody did because it is the winner.
it's like when you really look at it, you're just like, well, yeah, that makes sense.
It also just makes me think, like, what a shame it is that there weren't real, like, title reigns like this by the late 90s because, you know, Austin should have had a reign like this. Bret Hart should have had a reign like this. Rock should have had a reign like this. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, it was the nature of the business, right? Yeah. The fact that TV was such a huge part about – the late 90s was that long title reigns didn't really matter. It was more about what could you do to get people to tune in within three weeks or 2 weeks.
Yeah, I looked very hard to try to save Austin, but they're so short reigns.
There's just so short.
First reign, if you take out the Kane thing and you take out the kind of blip with the Undertaker and Kane.
That's the issue that
that one wasn't a blip. After that he didn't win the title back for months. So that's
until true. WrestleMania. WrestleMania.
They wanted him to chase every year.
That's what
his injury mid year. So
right.
Austin's best reign is probably when he turned heel and.
That is his best reign. That should have been an honorable mention, actually. WrestleMania 17. You got the angle matches, the angle series of matches.
He faced Spike Dudley on TV.
I will say this. If the matchups in the first round went a little differently, I could have seen that Cena reign going pretty far.
Right.
It happened to be up against Misawa right off the bat.
The Cena reign could have actually taken if it had been in the bottom bracket where Savage ended up in the semis, I think Cena could have actually moved along further.
Yeah, Cena probably could have gotten to the Joe matchup. Yeah.
Danielson as well could have gotten there as well, I think, in that one.
Mm-hmm.
I think with Kobashi, I think we miss a bit of the cultural element as well because we obviously are more immersed in what happens over here compared to what happens in Japan and to a certain extent outside. Oh, even though you can watch all this, you can follow along, but there's still a little bit of that element missing that we can get with the Joe ring, we get with the Hogan ring, that we get with a lot of these other rings as well.
The lasting impact of Kobashi's reign, just to pound that point home.
Mm-hmm.
He loses. Mm-hmm. They don't draw a full house at the Budokan for 2.5 years. The next time they do, it's his return match from cancer. The next match after that, his retirement match in 2011.
There you go.
I mean, like, if you guys are thinking about how much him being on top in 2003 to 2005 meant for what Noah did and what he meant to the Japanese wrestling community, it's like the Budokan was never full again until Kobashi was in the main event for those two shows. And they didn't have a full house again until New Japan decided to run that during the Sumo Hall renovation. So it's like, there you go, guys.
Between the Kobashi and Samoa Joe reigns, which one would you lean towards, Tim? It's a tough one. I know, because it's basically mirror images in a way.
I want to know Matt's answer too, but like part of me is like, I said, one of them is the definitive reign of their country, right?
Mm-hmm.
In my eyes, the other one is the biggest post 2000 title reign, I think, in the United States. And man, I don't know.
And kind of the template of what the wrestling landscape kind of looks like.
And it happened at the same time.
Yeah, they're contemporaneous reigns, basically. Yeah.
I don't know. I think if I were to do a gut shot, like first thing I think of, I would lean Kobashi just because I was so into that title reign as it was happening. So into it. So, yeah, I think I'd probably lean Kobashi, but it's not by much.
Yeah, I mean, I probably lean Kobashi, but at the same time, that Joe Reign just feels a lot more special to me. Yeah. The Kobashi Reign, just they had the big moments. They had the big, you know, Tokyo Dome shows, and, you know, his the match where he won the title was so much better, but the match where he lost the title was so much worse. Yeah. So,
like I said, the thing that hangs heavy over that title reign is that it ended on such an acrimonious note, in the sense that the company was never the same. And the big issue is, though, they needed something to run on top of the dome. They ran with Akiyama. And when you do that and you have to have Kobashi beat him, and you're not sure after Akiyama flopped the first time that you can go back to him to try and transfer that house, you have to try and make something happen with a new guy. It's like, you know, the business around that time was very like, man, there were some tough questions that needed to be answered at that time. So, but yeah, it's like Matt says, it's like that Joe Reign is, there's a reason why they just put three Samoa Joe matches up for the 18th anniversary of ROH.
Yeah.
It's like, come on. And it's like, that was an important thing. It was a defining thing for the company. So,
yeah.
Well, there we go. We at least got that comparison and discussion as well.
Oh, wow. What a show.
Yeah.
thank you. So anyone that's made it to the end here, I don't know how many. I know if I was listening to a podcast like this, it would take me like my way to work, my way home from work, the next day, going to work, probably. Type of thing.
Right.
But so thank you to anyone who did that for us. This was a hell of a fun discussion, and man, Hogan's Reign is the best of all time. That's I don't know. I don't like. I agree. Like going through the tournament, that's where I stand. But going into tonight, that's not what I thought would happen. So
right.
But that happened last tournament too. I didn't expect what one to win. So yeah, this format's interesting. Matt, do you have any maybe final words as the apocalypse is happening?
Yeah, I mean, I am very, very tired.
yes, as am I.
Yeah, hopefully just due to being on the podcast for a long time and no other illnesses. But I feel like we had a really good discussion. Man, we covered every base, didn't we?
Yeah.
We certainly did.
Yeah, one of the things I thought about coming in is like we're gonna talk in this one. Like this, there's gonna be no silences. This is gonna be quick discussions. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of meat on this bone, so
yeah.
Boy did we.
Yeah. Boy did we.
Marika? How you doing?
I'm doing good. I mean, nothing new to plug per se, but man, always a fun time discussing wrestling with you guys.
And you know, we're trying to do this a little more often than last year. Mm-hmm. If we all survive, maybe we'll get something in a month or so.
If we're quarantined, we'll need something to do.
That's
yeah,
true. Maybe we'll
say,
do
you might. We might be back here in a week. You never know.
Yeah, maybe my work will make me stay home. Who knows? There's already one building that's making everyone stay home in Toronto. So who knows? I think that's it, though. I think we're leaving. All right. Everyone, have a good night. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, you guys. Appreciate it.